Tonight on The Download, hip-hop legend from the refugee camp, Wyclef Jean. From Lifeway Foods and the author of the Kefir Cookbook, Julie Smolansky. And another episode of the Swap Meet with Greg Flamm. Now, here's your host, a man who still hasn't figured out how to cook rice, Justin Kaufman.
That was personal. That was personal communication. You need a FOIA. You need to the special prosecutor to get that information. Yeah, I screwed up rice. I don't know what I'm doing. You happy? Public shaming. No collusion on the rice.
Yeah.
I'm really on this kick where what happened to me just a couple days ago is I went to the Freshie across the way that's in the Walgreens. Love that place. But I went in to get a bowl right at the 6:30, and you got the exasperated response from the people who worked behind the counter because they had already cleaned the rice cooker. So it was like a, like my son does when he has to go clean the kitty litter. And I was like, what? And they're like, and then out of the blue, the worker said, starting next week, we have a new policy where we don't serve bowls after 6:30. I was like, well, what time are you open to? 8. Well, what? Okay, I'm done. And so I've now, this week, started making my own. I went to the internet, got the recipe of the bowl that I like, and I've been making all the ingredients myself. Right. The only problem is the rice. Everything else is pretty easy. It's fresh vegetables and a little, you know, cheese here and a little cherry tomato. But the rice you got to actually cook.
You can't just microwave it?
I probably could, but I went to the Whole Foods, you know, and I don't know if that's even a thing there. And so I was doing it in the pan, and it's fine. The first day I was supervised, so I did a good job. But today's was too watery. I thought it was done, then I poured it in, and it was just too watery.
Just get the, you know, because we get the we make the bowls all the time. Get the rice in the you know little just, packet, and just pop microwave. It in the microwave. Boom, put it in the bowl. Mix your stuff in there.
Do I look like I put microwave stuff in this body, Pete?
You're not a Maya. I understand. Mr. Health Conscious over there.
We got a great show lined up tonight. It's The Download, 720 WGN, and Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock. We're going to push pretty quick on this show because we have a ton of segments lined up, including Wyclef Jean, the famed hip-hop legend, member of the Fugees. He's got the Carnival tour coming up. The Carnival, his groundbreaking solo record. He's going to be at Metro on Sunday. We got some tickets to give away tonight, so we'll do that. And we're going to have him, we're going to try to squeeze him in right at the top of this hour. Instead of a carry out, we're going to do that. And then I'll tell you what else is on the show, which is a lot of great stuff. And don't worry, carry out, I can do it real quick for you. Paul Ryan's retiring. Access Hollywood tape is about collusion. Weather was awesome today. Cam Meredith's on the Saints. The Bulls season finale, the Cubs and Sox played, Khloe Kardashian, Tristan Thompson. There, I just did. You see that? That's pretty good. Maybe onto something. The microwaved version of the carryout. Never know. So, yeah, so we got that. We got a great show. And Greg Flamm is here tonight, and I brought my own life-size poster. I found a poster. Actually, my buddy Tommy sent it to me in the mail, which is a whole other thing. That was the hardest thing to ever have done, and he sent it in the mail. But, yeah, we'll talk about that. I got a Michael Jordan poster that I want to see if Greg can tell me if it's worth anything. So I'm playing along, too. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier. Production, Esmeralda Leon as well. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Wyclef Jean. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my first guest tonight is one of the legends of hip-hop, and he's coming back through Chicago this weekend, hitting up the Metro. He's got a new album out called The Carnival 3, The Rise and Fall of a Refugee, of course. Talking about the one and only Wyclef Jean. Raised with the Zoos on the block, drum roll with the band in my socks, twin Glock aimed at the ops, another one in the box. I told my whole gang they gotta meet me early. Told my kitchen they gotta bring the parsley. Told my shadow friend he gotta bring the M tree. Just in case they wanna do me like Kennedy. New Jack City boy Nino. That's my homie calling Medellin Pablo. Bishop gonna do what it takes. For the juice, kiss your mama at the wake.
Hoover boys called me Haitian Sinatra. Tap the wire, now they gotcha. Señorita, screaming cheeser. They found them things in the freezer. No retreater, hot like fever. Hit a rat, ta ta ta, that's the big sweeper. Shoot the leader, Mona Lisa. Fell from the wall.
Wyclef is a Grammy Award-winning MC, singer, instrumentalist, and producer. He's been in front of the mic, changing hip-hop forever with the Fugees, and of course still in heavy rotation from his groundbreaking solo album, The Carnival. It's been just over 20 years since that album came out, and 10 years since Carnival 2, so it's fitting that Carnival 3, The Rise and Fall of a Refugee, came out last fall. Wyclef is much more than a musician. He's a spokesperson, a politician, an advocate, and an educator. He just conducted a nationwide college talent search as part of his back-to-school project. The Haitian singer-songwriter is coming to Metro on Sunday, and it's my pleasure to welcome Wyclef Jean back to The Download tonight. Wyclef, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
What's up, man? That's a long, long list of things, man.
That's just scratching the surface of your brilliant career. Right at the beginning, I want to ask about Chicago, because you have come through with the Fugees. You've come through, and obviously, in your solo work. What are some of the memories of playing the city of Chicago?
I mean, Chicago is like playing home for me, you know? The diversity, the vibes. I also came up as a jazz major, right? Mm-hmm. So the history of Chicago is incredible musically, you know, to watch that morph over and over again. You know, I'm always fortunate to work with people before the over big blowing up. I got a chance to work with, like, Chance the Rapper, Young Cha, just different. Like, I'm very heavily connected to Chicago, you know what I mean? It's personal.
For you, you mentioned the jazz, you were a jazz major, and it goes deeper than that because you had a lot of music growing up. You, as others might be playing ball or possibly getting ready for a different career, you studied music, you studied songs. Talk about how music came to your life as a young child.
Well, I came from Haiti, you know, at a very young age, but I'd say it all started in Haiti, like that small village. The idea of, like, no electricity, no water, you know, you got to go for miles for water. But the village had, like, these old folks, and there was constantly, like, singing, chanting, you know, and always, like, being happy, the sound of the drums. And I always said, like, for me, that's where the spirit of it all started. Then I got to Marlboro Hope Projects in Brooklyn, and my father was, like, a missionary slash evangelist, Haitian evangelist. So in the house, like, we was not allowed to listen to anything but Christian music, you know what I mean? So everything else we was listening was through, like, headphones and sneaking it, you know? And as teenagers, you do exactly the opposite of what your parents said.
Right.
So we started listening to every hip-hop record you could think of, first rock record. So I was, like, a hip-hop reggae head. My brother was a rock head. So he shared music with me. He was like, yo, this the Police synchronicity. And I was like, what's that? Then I listened to Synchronicity, fell in love with it, Pink Floyd, The Wall. And then my mom was heavy into country music. I got into Johnny Cash. I don't know, man. It's like, if it's like Jeopardy, I'd be like, I'll take music for 500.
Well, you can hear all of those influences, especially on the Carnival records. And you can hear you even in your lyrics talking about that was then, this is now, talking about the Caribbean influence in your music and who you are. When you talk about this project and the Carnival records, the solo record that everybody knows, and even the two and the third that just came out, it's been a stretch of 20 years, and it's been those. What makes a song ready for a Carnival record?
Well, the Carnival, this is the trilogy, this is the conclusion of it. Quincy Jones taught me a word at a young age. The word is global gumbo. And, you know, a gumbo is like just a mix of everything, and it tastes so good, you know. What the vibes that I be getting for the Carnival records, it feels like culturally eclectic. That's probably the right word. You can hear the fusion, you know, in those kind of albums.
What I love about your music as well, and I have throughout your career, is that it is eclectic, the sounds, of course. But even the way you approach the music, because you'll have something that might just be straight-ahead rap, but then at the same time, you'll put a ballad on there. You were one of the first hip-hop artists to introduce singing as well as rapping. But also humor and seriousness. I mean, you have found a way to wrap up emotion in your music, and like you said, that global gumbo. Where does that come from? Where do you think it comes from that you're able to expand your palette and deliver all this different kind of music in one album?
I think the neighborhood. I was just channeling my neighborhood, you know what I mean? And the purest and funnest sense, you know? Because sometimes, like, you hear about the hood and all you hear about is the danger. But you don't hear, like, all of those funny kind of stories, you know what I mean? Like, on the carnival, I remember I was like, yo, this guy says he's a killer. So how many people exactly did you kill? You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, and that used to be one dude. I mean, this guy was, like, the biggest coward, but he would come with all these war stories. You know what I'm saying to you? I always find, because I always say one of my favorites is Dave Chappelle, mm-hmm. who I consider a good spiritual great, great friend, good, good guy. The idea of, like, taking the something that may not be uncomfortable, but you know people talking about it,
right,
and putting it through comedy or through music, I always say is the best way to express yourself.
With the Back to School Project, you are doing a nationwide college talent search, and you're developing a lot of young talent in your new projects. Talk about why you're doing this. Why are you, Wyclef Jean, deciding to go and pluck from the college ranks talented musicians to work with, when you could work with anybody?
Yeah, well, I'm a student of Quincy Jones, right? And I went to a small college called Five Town College, like, when nobody knew who I was, you know, and we had the dorm band and the campus band. And I'd say, man, every time we play outside on the campus, it's like literally 2,000 people there. And I feel like between, like, the last year of high school and college, a lot of talent is discovered. And I feel like through reality shows, like, that's one way to do it. Through YouTube views, that's one way to do it. But then there's the other way. What happened to someone who has, like, 3 views, but they could be the next Janis Joplin somewhere? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I just take the reverse of how everyone's moving with these because whether if it's Lauren, Beyonce, Whitney, Shakira, Mary J., and these are all people that I've written hits for, and I could keep going. Like, there's something about them which is raw, and keep in mind, in that era, there was really, like, no reality shows.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
They weren't stars when they started their careers.
No, but they were raw talent. So the idea I have for the mixtape is going to be 24 songs, and the idea is 12 Wyclef joints, and at the same time, I'll be featuring 12 joints from throughout the country that I feel is mind-boggling for this tape.
All right.
Also recruiting talent from different colleges that we go to, where I will be putting them on some of my material also. The tape is called Wyclef Goes Back to School, my next mixtape. Like, it's going to be crazy. Like, I'm going to have a lot of people that y'all know already that's out there. But the banging part about it is these students. Like, so, for example, the first single is called Sakapfet.
Yep.
It's, like, rocking right now. You can see my gram everywhere we go to spots. It's crazy. But that's featuring 2 people. One is Kofi Black, and the other girl is called Maura Mack, who's doing the ad-libs. And Maura Mack will get a full record on the mixtape.
Wow.
So Maura Mack, I discovered her in USC in one of, like, the Battle of the Stages. And now think about it. She's a college student. You could go on iTunes, and it's like Maura Mack, right? She don't have 100 million views, but if this girl picks up a guitar and starts to sing, it's going to blow you away. So for me, I still believe, like, that's one of the best ways to recruit the talent.
My last question for you, just to hear you talk about wanting to help young talent and to be able to talk about your experience and give it to somebody else. It's amazing to me to think of Wyclef Jean as an elder statesman in hip-hop. You know, somebody who has become one of the... You've been there. You're the wise man who can tell. When you see the young generation of hip-hop right now, and a lot of artists from Chicago, but others coming up, do you see yourself as that role? Do you see yourself as someone who's, hey, I've lived through major record labels, I've lived through big groups, I've lived through 8 studio albums, I've won Grammys, this is what I can tell you?
No, because Wyclef Goes Back to School means, like, we're sharing information, right? So... like, Quincy Jones ain't do Michael Jackson till he was 54. So I literally don't feel like I've done my best work yet. What I do feel is, like, whether if it's Kanye, when we met, I remember our conversation, and he spoke to me, like, 20 minutes about Gone to November, from the song mm-hmm. to the orchestra to the music video. When I saw Drake, he came up, he hugged me, yo, the carnival, you know. But what's dope is you can go online and you push up Wyclef Jean, and it's a Young Thug song called Wyclef Jean.
Of course.
You go online, and you push up Lady Haiti, and you go on Kodak Black Instagram, you see he finds this song, he's dancing with his mom, and Hendrix, and it goes on and on. And so the idea of, like, going from cassette tapes to streaming rates, and how do you stay there? I would like to see, like, not kids have, like, a 5 or 6 year career, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, Jay-Z was there since the beginning, Puff was there, Nas was there, Beyonce was there, we all was there, and we're still here. So I would like to see this new generation do, like, that 20 and 25 years, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And we're here, we fly, we not broke, you know what I'm saying? we got our mansions, we got our investments, but at the same time, unless you're passing the information to the youth, you know what I mean? It's very incredible. And people be like, yo, Clef, you really, like, you basically underplaying yourself with all these different venues. Like, why are you even coming back? And I'm doing this. And I said, I learned this from Prince. Like, every time you're going to put new music out, you have to start like you're starting in the beginning, which is the foundation. So you can't be like, oh, I'm so comfortable, people know who I am, I've sold 100 million records. No, you have to always remember, go out, touch people, feel people, and then let the youth see you. Because now the gang of kids that's in there, they're going to get inspired, yeah. And it's going to create a whole new wave.
The Carnival Tour is coming to the Metro on Sunday. Wyclef Jean, always a pleasure to have you on The Download. Thanks for joining us, and we look forward to the mixtape and more music, and the best is yet to come. Thanks, Wyclef.
All right, bless.
Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
I'm doing well, my friend. How are you?
Good. I gave away the tickets, so I'm sorry that you couldn't get the Wyclef.
Good interview, man. Good interview.
Yeah, it's great that he was second time on the show.
You always have quality guests, no doubt, but that's a big one.
I agree.
Yeah.
I went through some of the old Apple Music nostalgia memories of Wyclef, the Carnival.
Sure.
Playing some tracks. There's also, he's got a track, and I would play it all night. If we didn't have a huge show tonight, I'd play it nonstop. I'd play it every 4 minutes, where he remixes Kenny Rogers.
Oh.
It's the one, it's the You Got to Know When.
Sure.
He goes, yeah, yeah. It's the best song in the history of songs.
I think I might like that version better.
It is one of the best songs of all time.
Good stuff, man.
I don't like hyperbole, but it is the best song of all time.
And we're a little short on hyperbole up here. Yeah.
Thanks, Rob. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's time. It is Wednesday, so let's talk to the Daily Line. Of course, a publication that covers all things city, county, and state here in the state of Illinois. A.D. Quigg and Ray Hodge join us tonight. A.D. covers City Hall here and, of course, Cook County, and Ray down in Springfield. Thanks for joining us. Good to see you, A.D. And also, I wanted to introduce Ray. Ray, come on in. You there?
Hey, how's it going?
There you go. I got everybody. Good, good. Let's start with you, Ray. Today was a day in which Illinois did some work that was supposed to be done maybe 30 years ago. The Equal Rights Amendment.
Yeah, they might have been running a little bit behind there. You know, it might have been just a little bit delayed. Only about 36 years or
36
so.
Years.
However, the Senate did pass us a bill here, the Equal Rights Amendment, long overdue by a lot of the proponents that they're saying. The opponents, of course, say that this is not exactly something that needs to be done. But nevertheless, the Senate did clear it 42-12.
And so this is interesting because Senator Staines was talking about this concept of protecting the rights of Illinois residents just in case something at the federal level goes awry. And this is also what was at the heart of the abortion bill that was done before. This seems to be a very popular way to govern at this time in the state of Illinois.
Well, and you know, it's funny that you should say that because it's more federal than we normally see here. Normally, you know, with Illinois, there tends to be quite a bit of groundbreaking in terms of how the legislation works, and that's regardless of what topic it is. It tends to lead quite a bit. But in this case, you know, we've got 35 other, you know, states which have, you know, attempted to ratify this over the years, and this one has been in particular far delayed. But yeah, you're right. It cuts right to the quick of a specific piece of language that, you know, as short as this amendment is, all it really says is just that you can't discriminate on the basis of sex. So, I mean, in that vein, the proponents would argue, hey, you know, if there is a measure out there that would be overturned by it, then perhaps. It should be. I don't know. You know, so so that's the kind of the core of it, the root of it that they're going after.
And Illinois residents and voters and people who are listening to this program right now and seeing that news would probably scratch their head and not remember specifically that the state failed to pass or have a state version of the Equal Rights Amendment back 36 years ago. So they might be scratching their head wondering why this is happening today.
Well, you know, it's funny, too. One of the things that if you start to look into the research, it seems like Illinois, given its legislative history in the last 20 years or so, or even over the last 40 years, it's been pretty quick to adopt protections that are, you know, legally focused on discriminated parties in terms of just state house mechanisms. But it's actually interesting that Illinois, you know, for many years ago, when the first protections for women started to be legislated federally and on a state level, it was quite a leader as far back as 1912, even. I mean, not to take everybody on a history lesson here, but there you have it. You know, this is a sort of a return to a trend, historically speaking, for the state. And unfortunately, you know, there are so many other issues that have been brought up that had to be brought up to a head in order to start asking these core questions, things about sexual harassment, payouts, equal wage parity, workplace protections for women. I think all these are starting to really coalesce. It could be, as the ERA proponents say, this is one way to sort of clear them all.
Yeah. One thing that's not being talked about today, but it's on everybody's mind, is the override, the veto override of the gun licensing bill. This was a bill that right after, I think it was right after Parkland, Florida, that was put on to put a little bit more restriction on gun owners through gun dealers and essentially being able to training to recognize straw ownerships or straw dealers that might be using illegal guns, some other things as well. This was vetoed by the governor right before the primary. People said it was political for him to appeal to a base of his party. But where are we? Because the seems that the Senate and the House leadership wants to override the veto, but they may not have the votes.
Well, I tell you, you know, today was a very critical turning point in this gun debate issue. The bill that we're talking about here, it's Senator Don Harmon. He's a Democrat out of Oak Park. And he's actually been working this gun dealer licensing bill for something like 10 years, right? So this isn't just something that sparked hastily after the Parkland shootings, but rather now, because of those unfortunate tragedies, there's a great deal of support and momentum that this bill has never seen. But this bill has been worked to find compromises with gun owners, regionally, downstate, associations, lobbying. Everybody's had a hand in being able to really put their mark on this thing and work together on something here. I mean, the hearings have been extensive. But today, one of the most crucial things, just as you're saying, with the Republican sort of opposition to that, a poll came out today that showed overwhelming support for this gun dealer licensing bill. I mean, we're talking about 71% are in favor, 23% are against.
And these are Illinois residents we're talking about.
Democrat poll or some Republican poll, right? These are both,
right.
Both of these parties.
Yeah, and have you talked to do lawmakers seem some that might have been, you know, sort of cemented in their opposition or in their you know, whether or not they're for it, seeing this poll, these poll numbers and maybe changing their to where they're at?
I tell you what, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, this being a deadline week in the state house, it's kind of like when the circus comes to town, right? All the lights kick on. I counted up the number of bills here, and just in this one week, the number of House bills was over 700 bills, right?
Wow.
So everything is sort of crazy in a whirlwind, and everyone's moving as fast as they can. So when this poll dropped today, however, the conversation, that's when it really started to take a change in tone. When we saw that veto, it was right before the primary, right? And a lot of people, you know, critics perhaps of the governor, or even some supporters of him, said, this is him throwing a bone to his base. You know, he wants to appear strong and pro-NRA. Well, some of the key places where the governor and where many GOP leaders are looking right now for fall are in those sort of western suburban districts. Those tend to be a little less pro-gun, but still very strongly GOP. Interestingly enough, among this poll, that exact area favored gun control, and in fact favored this particular gun licensing bill at almost 75%. So those lawmakers who have been kind of on the fence about it, if they haven't started talking to their, you know, their folks back home about this bill again, then today's probably going to be the day that those start, because finding out that 75% of a key swing voting bloc for Republicans are favoring a piece of legislation, that's a conversation starter.
Ray Hodge, she covers Springfield politics for the Daily Line, dailyline.net. Joins us Wednesdays. A.D. Quigg is also here. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, A.D. will join us. We'll talk about some stuff that's happening and whether or not we're going to see some big leaders in city council skip the re-election process, just decide that they're done, their careers are over, they had a good run.
They want to spend more time with their families.
They want to spend more time with their families. Have that conversation coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. So Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're talking with A.D. Quigg and Ray Hodge. We've now turned to A.D. Quigg from The Daily Line to talk about some storylines in Chicago politics. Alderman, of course, the municipal election coming up here in February, the primary. And this is interesting because a lot of aldermen at this juncture right about now are going to start making decisions on whether or not they're going to run for re-election.
Right.
So you're starting to see some aldermen say, it was a good run, but I'm out.
Yeah. So we know that two aren't running already. That's Amaya Pawar, who ran for governor. He term limited himself as alderman, and there's already like seven people running for his seat up on the north side in Ravenswood. Alderman Willie Cochran, who was indicted on federal bribery charges, also announced that he will not be running. He didn't say it was because of the indictment. I think he said it was because he collapsed on the floor of city council.
Health reasons.
Yes. Was unconscious on the floor of city council. There's already two people running there, and I would expect that one to get
pretty
crowded. That's
so Chicago, though. That's so Chicago to be like, yes, I was unconscious on the floor, but I'm also got federal indictments for bribery. But you know what? It's too much for me, guys.
It's too much. I mean, it's stressful to be indicted.
Yeah.
So that's two seats. On Monday, Alderman Mike Selesky from the 23rd Ward, which is on the southwest side, announced he is retiring. He said there was no funny business, no big conspiracy to slate some Mike Madigan candidate. He just said, I need to spend time with my wife. She's going through her fourth surgery. My wife takes care of my mother, who is still alive. I just want to hang out with my family, so I'm out. That means the mayor will get to appoint his successor. Usually he'll put together a panel of four people, and those four people will open up applications, and everyone will apply, and then we'll get a pre-slated candidate kind
of
in the spot.
Well, I mean, as you just said, no funny business, but why not just not run for re-election?
He said that he didn't want to pretend like he was running. He just said, I want to get out, which allows other people to organize. And the way he put it was, whoever the mayor appoints, they'll have a certain amount of time to prove if they're up for the task. Which is, I mean, it's just a classic Chicago thing to announce your retirement, retire a month later, and then let someone be in office for a few months so people know their name and they can take care of your garbage for a while. And then you're like, they do an okay job. They can stay.
That's so true. Like, anyway. Okay, so there is going to be some competition. What about some of the big names? Like Alderman Ed Burke. We talked about this right after the primary election where his brother Dan Burke was beat in the primary for his state rep seat. And the organization that's really run by Chuy Garcia said, we're kind of looking at Alderman Ed Burke as well, saying, you know what, you might want to say it's been a great career because we're gunning for you. So has there been any talk about whether or not Alderman Ed Burke will hang him up?
There's been talk. He has never struck me as a guy who goes down without a fight, and he's got a ton of money. So I wouldn't be surprised if he would duke it out. He's held power in that ward for 50 years, which is hard to topple.
That is not a round number. You didn't just estimate. That's 50 years.
he's been alderman for 50, since he was 26 years old. So familiar name, tons of money. He takes care of ward services like you want your alderman to do. You've got your street plowed and your potholes filled and stuff like that. What I'm curious about is whether Chuy Garcia and Our Revolution, Clem Balanoff, just go after Burke, or if they try to go after a lot of other old regular Democrats on the southwest side where their power is most concentrated. So Zaleski's on that side of town. Marty Quinn's on that side of town. I'll be excited if I'll be excited to see if they go after multiple candidates or if they just go, Ed Burke, we're getting him out so we can have someone new in finance committee.
Because it's not that often. And we saw this before that the teachers union in the last election, they slated a couple of candidates to take on some of the entrenched aldermen and city council. And we've seen a progressive movement the last election through. We saw some new faces, some new voices that came into council. Do we expect the same from Labor? Do you expect that they're going to mount campaigns against some of the entrenched Democrat aldermen in Chicago?
Definitely. And we also have, there's Cook County Democratic Party leadership elections next week. And we have candidates, including Tony Preckwinkle, who have said we cannot ignore progressive movements anymore. And we need to bring in Labor as well, because both delivered big time in the 2018 elections. And we expect them to be able to deliver again. And they have the kind of ground game that old patronage ward organizations don't have anymore. So.
Interesting. That's next week. That's a big one. That's Joe Berrios versus Tony Preckwinkle.
No. Well, Joe Berrios has not announced that he is not running, but I would be surprised if he ran again. Tony Preckwinkle came out early and said, I'm running. We're going to bring in progressive groups. We're going to bring in Labor. We're going to bring in people of color.
So does she have any challenge for that slot?
So there have been names floating around. Paul Rosenfeld, who is 47th Ward Democratic Committeeman, who super duper increased voter participation in that ward, has also come out with a plan and said, we need to bring in progressive groups. We need to bring in Labor. I went from the 47th ward, went from the 29th ranked for voter turnout to the second in the time that I've been there. So I'm good at getting out the vote. And the way I did that was by organizing around issues. Mm. I'm not sure how good of a chance he has. Tony Preckwinkle was making calls very early and she had a very decisive win, for Cook County board president. But at the very least, I think no matter what, we're going to see more progressives, more labor groups involved.
I would love to read that story, the book written about how everyone was calling for the end of Tony Preckwinkle after the soda tax. And there's no way she's going to win. And not only does she just wipe the floor with former Alderman Bob Fioretti, she's now poised to take over the chair of the Democratic Party in Cook County, which is a huge position, especially, of course, in state politics as well.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see how decisive that win is, like if she goes in and just sweeps it, or if she has to make some major concessions to other people that are running. Louis Arroyo Sr., the state rep, is also in the running. Alderman Anthony Beal is interested. There are a bunch of people calling her, I'm sure, saying, put me on the executive committee, which I'm not sure how much power you get, but it's nice to be listed, and you get to go to all the meetings, and you get some money and some staff.
Yeah. We got about 1 minute left, and we might want to do this in a bigger way next time we talk, but the police reform movement in city council is a head-scratcher. You had a lot of movement with the consent decree that came from the Department of Justice, and also the mayor and everyone standing in front of the podium after the Laquan McDonald video saying, we are going to change. There was this idea that we'd have a civilian oversight board that would actually have teeth. It wouldn't be advisory, but then so overnight, there's a little change around.
Right.
And now what's in front of one of the ideas is that we would have a committee, but it would just be advisory.
Right. So there are four ordinances now pending that would create some kind of civilian oversight for CPD. And this has been kind of simmering for 2.5 years now. So we have two kind of more radical ones. We have CPAC, which would abolish the police board, abolish COPA. We've got the GAPA ordinance, which is kind of a coalition of community groups, which has more teeth and has the backing of quite a few aldermen. And then out of left field, Alderman Ariel Roboyris, who is very close to the mayor, introduced two ordinances the same day as the GAPA ordinance, and they're purely advisory. Now, Roboyris has said that the mayor is not involved at all, which a lot of people don't believe, but I can't imagine that it looks terribly good for the mayor.
And what does the mayor say?
He has said he wants it to be, whatever comes out of this, he wants it to be complementary, not contradictory, which I think means don't abolish any existing oversight bodies that we have. Don't get rid of the police board, don't get rid of COPA, and don't take a ton of power away from Superintendent Eddie Johnson.
Well, I have a soft spot for Roboyris because he threw out the first pitch in our 16-inch softball league one year.
Oh, wow.
So I just want to throw it out as a conflict. I have a conflict in this conversation.
Was it a good pitch?
I don't remember. I just remember he brought the alderman out as a bid. It was good. Adi Quigg, she covers all things city and Cook County. And Ray Hodge, who joined us as well, covers all things Springfield for the Daily Line. You can find out all that at dailyline.net. They join us every Wednesday. Adi, great to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is making her triumphant return to The Download. Julie Smolansky is the CEO of Lifeway Foods, the company that makes kefir and other probiotic products. The company is one of Chicago's best, starting off in a basement in Skokie over 30 years ago and turning into a multi-million dollar company with over 350 employees. Lifeway is a family business as Julie and her brother Ed run the company and have taken it from a literal mom-and-pop shop to something much, much bigger. Julie took over the company back in 2002 after her father died suddenly. She became the youngest woman ever to run a publicly traded company. As healthy living through probiotics continues to be important to consumers, Smolansky is right on trend. She just released the Kefir Cookbook. It's a collection of recipes that also serves as a part memoir, A Life Lived Through Kefir. And as the Chicago Reader said recently, it's a love letter to Chicago written in cultured milk. Julie Smolansky, my guest tonight. Julie, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And full disclosure, my wife does work for Lifeway Foods, so I want to put that out there.
We love her.
A big company, but it's great to have you here, and thanks for coming back. So this is part cookbook, but it's also part memoir. Why do it this way? Why bring the two together? Why not write a memoir and a cookbook, or write one or the other?
Well, I think today consumers really want to know a little bit more about their food. They want to hear the stories behind it. And for Lifeway, I really wanted to preserve a lot of the stories of how we started. I mean, it's rich in stories. And kefir itself is a 2,000-year-old product that survived through storytelling and was passed down through word of mouth. And so to me, it's like the modern version of that is to tell these stories of how we settled here in Chicago as refugees, how my parents hustled, some of the different business elements and parts of their lives that people maybe didn't know, or the history of Lifeway that, you know, it was so far away that we even forgot about it. And some of the stories I started to come back to me as I was writing the book and creating the recipes. But it was really like, you know, I started to think back across my life and the history of Lifeway, and I recognized that there were so many great, rich stories, and kefir had some sort of element in them all, or if it didn't, I certainly made it so.
I know the story, of course, because I've had you on before, and also family works for the company, but at the same time, there's so much I didn't know. And, you know, when you talk about kefir and it being such an old product and well known in Eastern Europe, but fairly new here, and a lot of it because of your family brought it over, how important was kefir to you as a kid growing up and just having that and your family being involved in the business and having the deli? But how important do you think this food was to your upbringing?
I mean, to me, it was everything. It was like a third sibling, honestly, because it did take my parents away. I had a little bit of resentment for it when I was a kid. But at the same time, it was a symbol of the American dream, and it was a symbol of resilience and survival and prosperity and healing and community. You know, we built this company around community and actually on the shoulders of Chicago. We wouldn't be where we are today if Chicago wasn't the welcoming city that it is. You know, I recently saw that the mayor just made us one of the sanctuary cities and continue to be open-minded to refugees and immigrants and diversity. And I think that's what makes our city so beautiful. And that's what is special about this book is that I tell a lot of these stories of Chicago, of the various people that have helped us or that, you know, we've built it together. I mean, I really feel like it is a love letter to Chicago. And there's some really great stories like... Before we started Lifeway, my parents got in the food business, and my mom opened a deli, and my dad was delivering caviar around town. So whatever was left over in excess, my mom said, well, who else eats caviar but Russians? And he said, well, the Japanese eat it. So there was 5 sushi restaurants in town. This was 1979-ish. And Kamahachi was one of them. Right. And the owner there, Mrs. Kenoshi, I was like 5 years old, and it was about 11 o'clock at night. There was no one left in the restaurant, and she sat me down and she gave me tamago, and we talked, and she was like this really warm grandmother, and my father and her had a really great relationship, and it was like this moment of two immigrants, one from Japan and one from Russia or Ukraine, Soviet Union, and they shared this moment. And, you know, I took that memory and I created deviled eggs with it, you know, with a blend of kefir and caviar and it's those kind of stories that are not really well known and are really heartwarming. And I think that's what people want their souls touched. And to me, it's very touching to me.
Well, it also, and reading it, and that's why I say it's part memoir, part cookbook, the ability to see how a story of your family and Kiefer and the recollections and your memories actually manifest themselves into recipes. You know, I guess the question would be, you know, because it is a book that really takes the product of kefir and puts it into a lot of recipes that you wouldn't think it would be in.
Unexpected.
Was that a part of your upbringing? Was kefir used in different ways, or was it always, hey, this is kefir. We do this over here, and we're gonna have steak over here.
Yeah. We did a little bit of both, but mostly it was separate. My parents did use it for all sorts of dressings and, you know, soups and stuff like that. My dad was always using it everywhere. And I do too, actually. I've always used it as a substitute for mayonnaise or sour cream, heavy cream. I've used it all various ways. I will find a way to use it, even if it wasn't part of, the genre of the meal. I mean, to me, it's a platform to share these stories and these recipes. It was a great way to tell them the stories individually and come up with really interesting recipes too, and some stuff that was even unexpected for me that sort of evolved as I was writing it.
Julie Smolansky is the CEO at Lifeway Foods, and she's got a new kefir cookbook, which is out now. She's my guest tonight. There's so much great stuff in here. You got the kefir battered fried chicken, the polenta, some of the stuff that grabbed my attention, the farmer's cheese, which I have a lot of questions about because I know a lot about that. But Julie Smolansky in studio tonight, my guest, as we talk about the kefir cookbook. Let's take a break. We'll come back, continue the conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Julie Smolansky is my guest. She's the CEO of Lifeway Foods and, of course, has the Kefir Cookbook, which the reader is such a great title, A Love Letter to Chicago Written in Cultured Milk. I love that. That's so great. Kefir, I feel like more and more consumers are aware of this product. But at the same time, there's a lot that still needs to happen with it. There are a lot of people who may just think it's yogurt or not really understand what the probiotic is. So before we move on, because we said kefir a lot of times without explaining it, what is kefir?
So it's a probiotic cultured dairy product. It's a particular blend of probiotic cultures. There's kefir cultures. And I mentioned it's got 2,000 years of folklore and history. And in 1908 was the first science and research that was done around it. Elie Metchnikoff won the Nobel Prize around his research around it and the health benefits that it offered. So, you know, since 1908, it's really got more and more traction. Mm-hmm. And it continues to grow. I mean, every year, science and research is finally catching up to what we knew intuitively in our gut, that when people consumed it, that they felt better. That's basically the gist of it. The probiotics are really important to our gut, and having diversified bacteria and microflora is really important because our modern lifestyle has basically destroyed our natural microflora. Things like antibiotics or the overuse of antibiotics, hand sanitizers, mm-hmm. antibacterial soaps, getting on a plane and having stress and travel and all various medications, all of those things disrupt the natural microflora. And the body still naturally has, it wants to fight something. And so if you're not getting these various bacteria that it needs to fight, then it starts to fight itself. So there's this belief that the epidemic of autoimmune diseases, allergies, asthma, ADHD, those kinds of conditions we now believe are the result of this the disruption of microflora. Yeah, that's interesting. The microbiome is one of the most interesting things happening right now in science and the combination of food. And we're learning so much that, like, the gut is a second brain and that we actually are learning so much about the second brain. And it's sending us intuitive messages all the time. When you think about your intuition or, you know, I had a gut feeling, that is actually a second brain. There are actually messages that are coming through. And we're learning now that we can manipulate our mood, anxiety, depression, stress through our gut and with the replenishment of microflora. So to me, it's such an exciting time to be leading in wellness and food and probiotics and kefir. And yes, it's still so unknown. I mean, we're just learning about this. It's fascinating.
And what I love about that, because that's a scientific side that you just talked about.
Right.
But a lot of the stories in here are personal.
Yes.
And as you go on book tour, and now you're the nationwide tour going all over the place, more and more people are coming out of the woodwork to give their personal stories.
It's amazing.
To talk about how your product or kefir or probiotics in general have changed their life.
Yeah, I was blown away by some of the stories that I'm hearing from my consumers. I mean, I'm a little bit removed from the day-to-day customer service calls, but I mean, I remember taking them, and they're in the book. I remember taking them, you know, when I was just starting at Lifeway and hearing these calls, and they continue to be so humbling and inspiring, and it fuels all of, you know, this work and energy. It like gives me purpose to it, because I'm reminded how life-changing or adding to the quality of life that is happening through this product and really healing. I had one woman who came up to me with tears in her eyes, crying. She said, "Thank you for making this product. My sister was dying of cancer, and this was she only could drink your peach kefir. It was the only thing that she could hold down. It was the only thing that gave her like comfort." And you think, like, you're sick and you can't eat anything and you're hungry, and that just made me feel so good to hear that in these last days that she had some sort of quality that improved her mood in some way. That's really touching. Or people just hear about our personal struggles or some of the challenges. I've certainly overcome a lot of adversity. People tell me that they're inspired by my personal story or my family's personal story, and that it gives them motivation to keep going or to, you know, get out of the box and do some challenging things. I mean, those are all worth it. That's why we tell these stories. You know, I really wanted for people to hear about the hustle and how it wasn't so easy, you know, that there was so much struggle and that there was a fight to get to this point. And this is like a new fight.
Well, it's amazing to think about, because there's going to be your personal story and there's going to be your family's story, you know, as we get to better understand it. And I have to be honest that I feel like the story of Lifeway and your family is becoming more and more known to Chicago. This idea that started out in the basement in Skokie, and then it's now, like I said earlier, it's now 350 employees. But let's talk about that, because a lot of the story, and pulled this out of the book as well, you know, always centered around your dad.
Yeah.
It was your dad was kind of the face of it.
Right.
But it was literally a mom and pop organization. Your mom played a huge role in making kefir what it is today, making Lifeway what it is today.
Yeah, she was really the brains of the operation. You know, when she came, she was 28 when they left and when they came here. And
from the Soviet Union.
Yeah. And it was 1976 when we landed, and you know, she didn't know that Women's Lib was happening or that Gloria Steinem was a thing, or, you know, she just knew she had to put food on the table. And it was very maternal and natural for her to do that through food. So she recognized that while there was so much food in the United States and Chicago, it was very different than what she was used to, than her staples from Eastern Europe. And she recognized that there would be an exodus from the Soviet Union of immigrants. And so, of course, the first thing is food. That's the first thing you get when you land. And so she opened the first deli in Rogers Park on Devon, and it became the town square for our Russian community, for the immigrants that were coming. People came and they, you know, had a pierogi, they had some gossip. So she saw that. And the other interesting thing was that everyone in that immigration process had to sit in Italy and wait for their paperwork to come, the green card and the approval to be allowed into the U.S. So we were in Italy for 3 months, and it was the first time she tried Nutella. And she said, everyone's going to be coming to America, to Chicago, and they're going to want Nutella because they had just tried it in Italy, and they were all going to fall in love with it. We need to import Nutella. So she had the first international contract to import Nutella into the United States before Nutella was ever known.
Wow.
And so she had it in her little shop on Devon. She had the first cases of Nutella. And, you know, it's this foresight that women especially want to, you know, we food is love. It's how we nurture. It's how we bring people together, especially at that time. So that's my mom. Her hustle was insane.
There's a great picture, too, of her at the Lifeway, one of the first Lifeway food trade shows.
Booth.
Yeah, the booth. Yeah.
And so she was the one that got us into the food industry. And so she became an importer and distributor of Eastern European food all over the U.S. So all the delis that were happening, you know, there was some in Brighton Beach, in L.A., all these Russian delis opening up. So she became a food mogul with all, you know, mostly men. There weren't really women in the space, and she was cutting all these deals on her own. And when they went to Germany in 85 on a trade show, food buying show, that's when my dad bought 3 bottles of kefir, and he hadn't had it since he left Russia. And my mom said, well, you know, you're an engineer. Why don't you build the plant and make it, and I'll sell it in my network? And so they kind of, that's how they started it.
That's a literal mom and pop
shop. Literal. And 6 months later, you know, what's interesting is that they didn't wait. They just jumped on it. They weren't waiting for the perfect logo or the perfect this or that. They went. They like had the idea. 6 months later, they incorporated it. 2 years later, they took it public. So it was just, they never sat. They risked and they, you know, absolutely made themselves uncomfortable. I don't know if I had the guts to do what they did.
Well, let's talk about your story. We'll take a quick break here and get an update on tonight's news. Julie Smolansky is the CEO of Lifeway Foods, and makes kefir and other probiotic products. Company, of course, now a multi-million-dollar company with over 350 employees. A far cry from the basement making kefir back in the day. Okay, we'll take a quick break. Julie's here for her new kefir cookbook. That's what we're talking about tonight. We'll get the news and we'll come back and continue the conversation. Julie Smolansky, stay with us. Welcome back to Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Julie Smolansky is here. She's the CEO of Lifeway Foods, and she's also the author of the Kefir Cookbook, which is a collection of recipes surrounding kefir and other probiotic products, of course, and it also serves as a part memoir for her life lived through kefir. We talked right before the news about your family's story. Your story is one as well, though, that is, it's continued to be honored. What was it, 2 weeks ago or so that you were ringing the bell at NASDAQ?
Thank you, yeah.
And this concept of you being the youngest woman ever to run a publicly traded company. Your father died suddenly in 2002.
Right.
And you were up. It was your turn to run this company. Take us to that moment. Take us to 2002 when that was bestowed upon you.
Yeah. It was devastating. I mean, it was generally like a one-man operation. I was very lucky that I decided to come work for him and learn the business. For 5 years, I'd worked with him side by side. My brother had just finished college. He was 6 months out. And then this happened on a sunny summer morning, and it was devastating. And the next morning, I mean, it was like the sky was falling, literally, like NASDAQ halted trading. The stock was just dropping, like there was no bottom to it. And my world was upside down. I mean, it was unbelievable that this happened. My father was a leader in the community. It was a very big loss for the whole community. And, you know, his best friend to me that day said, there's no way a 27-year-old girl can run the company. Sell your stock. The company's over. And, you know, I was educated in the United States. I had learned. I had a small network. I was disappointed that people just immediately assumed that I couldn't do it, and that they didn't think that maybe, you know, offering support would have been the better way in trying to make it all happen, right?
Even earlier in this interview, talking about your mom's ability to cut through it, to be the business person, to provide that hustle.
Right.
It's in your family.
It's in the family.
There's already history there.
Right. Yeah. We do have a hustle. It's like in our DNA, I guess. Or like the need to, the desire to survive and thrive. That's it. Also, we want to thrive. But, you know, to me, I thought about all that my parents had gone through and all that we'd been through together and how hard they worked. And I wasn't going to let it fall. I wasn't going to let it slip. And luckily, we were in a financially secure place as a company. So, you know, the banks were okay, which is usually the first calls that you get from the banks. And, you know, for 4 years, I put my head down and I worked like 22-hour days. I really pushed myself. It was really, really hard. Nothing came easy. Even this is not easy. This has been challenging too. And there is no such thing as an easy way. Everything is hard. It looks easy on the outside. It is not. It is always work.
What's amazing, though, about the story of Lifeway, and it's in the book, but it's also just knowing the story of the company that's right here in the Chicago area, is that it did go from a publicly traded company that was doing really, really well, well-known to a community. Mm-hmm. But under your leadership, in the next 10 years, tripled, quadrupled. It got to a point where you were able to introduce the product to a different demographic.
Yeah.
And that's really what's made it thrive even to this day, yeah, in 2018.
I want it to be mainstream. I want it in the hands of everybody. I want it to be able to heal people. I mean, that's really the goal, is that we want to heal as many people. I think it should be worldwide, and we've made those steps to try to go worldwide. And I think that it has the potential to continue to grow as big as any iconic brand.
Okay, let me ask you a 2018 business question. Probiotics, the lid has been blown off.
Yes,
of probiotics. Everyone knows about it now, right?
Thank God.
A lot of your competition knows about
mm-hmm.
it. And they are starting to put out products, and they're starting to look at that marketplace as
right.
one that used to be niche, and now it's mainstream.
Right.
How does Lifeway Foods, how do you stay above the fray? How do you continue to have this be your product, but also be able to compete with the other yogurt brands and
right.
other brands that are trying to get in the business?
That's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, was to tell that story and to show that we were the original. We are the original, and it's authentic. It's real. It's the real deal. Real stories, real people. A lot of the companies that are behind it are not Lifeway, other companies that are coming in. It's like, you know, a bunch of private equity guys. They see mm-hmm. some target. They can get some money out of it. They can take a piece of the fragment. So I think consumers can see through that, though, and we are the experts in kefir. Like, we've been doing it for over three decades now. So I've seen a lot of mistakes. We've made a lot of mistakes. I'm going to be watching them make those mistakes, because I know all the mistakes that they're going to make. I can see them already. And listen, a rising tide raises all ships. The more people that are talking about this category and bringing attention mm-hmm. to it, the better. It helps all of us. I am certainly concerned about the using the word incorrectly, which
right.
is happening, and we continue to fight and watch that.
It becomes a marketing issue. Now they realize, and we've seen this through all sorts of products.
It's
not
problem.
Just probiotics, but others where you get these healthy buzzwords and they're able to say, this may have all sugar, but it's also really good for you. There is this opportunity that other companies, mainstream yogurt companies, are like, just slap that word on
yeah.
and we'll take some of that business.
That's the big problem. But I think consumers today are so smart. They do so much great research. There's so much out there that they can, you know, actually be empowered to go and do the research around it. And we'll continue to try to educate as many as we can around it. And unfortunately, our FDA is not very big on actual regulatory. They don't actually go
right.
and arrest you if you're mislabeling product or anything. So that's a problem. And we will fight for this word and this category till our dying day.
Mm-hmm.
This product to me is so much more than just a product. It is, I feel that I'm the...
It's almost like you're responsible for this.
yeah. I guess that's a good way to phrase it. And I need to protect it
yeah.
And guard it to some extent, because I do want the word to continue to survive another 2,000 years and into infinity.
Yeah.
It should. It really should.
Well, this book, it's surprising to me too, because this cookbook is the first of its kind. There are no other yogurt companies. There's no other companies that are even trying to use or find different ways to use their product. They're like, this is what it is. It's drinkable yogurt or this
right.
is whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But they're not finding different ways. So how important
yeah.
is it for you to have a book like this that is trying to obviously prop up kefir, but also
yeah.
show there are other ways to use it?
Yeah, it was really important for me to show the versatility of kefir and all the ways that you can use it. Because I think today's chefs, even like everyday home chefs, they want something new to create. They want to tell that story. They want to show off on Instagram something interesting that they've made or some ingredient. You know, the use of a superfood in cooking is really, really exciting right now. So people have been trying to, you know, play with more dynamic flavors, more complex flavors and interesting stories, because it's part of the storytelling. You know, you sit mm-hmm. down at a restaurant, you get a little story from the waiter, from a sommelier about either a wine company or, you know, how a wine is made. And that's what I want to do with kefir too. I want to be more thoughtful and mindful about how food is made, who's making it, where it came from, why a particular recipe. And so I wanted to give a fuller experience to my consumers and my readers. So that, you know, some of my recipes even come with a secret Spotify playlist that I've been rolling out. I just started rolling it out yesterday. So, you know, again, it's like, we can have really beautiful, mindful experiences that don't cost a lot, that mm-hmm. are really special and important. And I think, you know, it's sort of the way that we connect with each other and ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And Lifeway is so much more than kefir, you know? That's the thing. It's way complex and layered.
My last question for you, just as you know, as we take it back to the deli on Devon and the community.
Yeah.
And as you reach out and say things like Spotify playlist or possibly talk about competing in stores for this product for a more mainstream demographic, the people that you're hiring are younger and they're more suited for that. But there's this great mix with your company because it also is a company that is a family company with a lot of older Russian workers in the business that balance it out.
Mm-hmm.
How important is community to Lifeway? How important is it? Because beyond Chicago, but just this idea of being able to balance what you need today and what you've had all along.
I absolutely believe community. I more and more am understanding how important community is. For many of us, without community, we would not have survived. And I think back to my parents. So my great-grandparents were victims of the Holocaust. They were murdered in their homes, and my grandmother escaped, and she survived. And she survived because of the community that was around her, that her parents, my great-grandparents, had built, and people owed them favors. And she was able to call on those. And my dad survived and my mom survived because of the various ways that they used their community and their community used them to help each other. It was part of survival. You know, you knew people. If you could help somebody, if they could help you, that became community. We shared this struggle together. And the same thing here, when we came to the U.S., we built a community around us. And when things do go sideways, you do lean on your community and vice versa. And so it is a symbiotic relationship. And we do have this diverse, eclectic group of people on our team. It feels like a family. You know, it doesn't feel like it's a job. It feels like it very much like a family. And it's like the crazy Russian grandma's there and the crazy, you know, uncle, and all of the characters are there. And somehow we are aligned on this vision to bring Lifeway to a bigger mainstream crowd and market, and to help people introduce this product into their lives and to heal people. I always say we are healers. No matter who you are in the company, you are part of a system of healing. And that is so special. And I think it helps give everyone purpose, and it helps align us all on this vision. And so, yeah, I think this diverse, eclectic group, it's what makes us strong, and it makes us who we are.
Do you think your dad would be trying out some of these recipes and using kefir in this way?
Yeah. Well, some, like this Chicago scramble is basically his. I remember being a kid and him making this for me on Sunday mornings.
Julie Smolansky is the CEO of Lifeway Foods and also the author of the Kefir Cookbook and the Spotify playlist that is associated as well. Julie, thanks so much for being here. We appreciate
it. Thank you. So fun.
Did you change workout clothes? My favorite.
He's pretty ripped.
He'll never be able to live that down. The video and pictures of him working out.
Yeah.
Dumbbells and the sweatpants. That's all I ask. Whoever's going to be the next Speaker of the House, they have to show us their workout videos before they can have that job.
Yeah.
That should be part of the prereq for being Speaker of the House.
Yeah. Maybe Nancy Pelosi can get
right
back in there.
I don't care. I mean, if it could be someone new, I don't care who it is. Either party. They just got to don the headband, put some cut-off sweats on.
Want to see somebody in there working out with those big rubber bands.
Yeah.
Boom.
Exactly.
It's the only Obama can't take away these guns. Sorry. Got it.
I love everyone speculating on, you know, I don't want to spoil what's going to be coming up in the
It's all right. He's not running for re-election. Yeah. That's the story.
Well, they talked about the progressive movement, and he was really worried about the blue wave. And that might be possible, and I could see him easily saying, I don't want to deal with the challenge. But I saw something which was stronger speculation, that what if this is a beginning of possibly an exploration for a presidential run?
Mm-hmm.
You don't think about that. I mean, this would be a way for him to step out of that shell, to get out of there, say he had accomplishments in Congress, and then when the Republicans want to run somebody against Donald Trump in the primary in 2020, Ryan's ready to go.
You're the Speaker of the House, which means you're second
right
in line. I mean, it's tangible. You could probably taste it.
And you would probably have to, you'd give up, isn't it work that you'd have to give up your seat anyway if you're going to run for something? So why not give it up early to explore?
His kids aren't getting any younger, Justin.
Right. Sorry. I don't know. He wanted to teach him curls. I don't even know what you actually call the different workouts.
Yeah, it's a curl, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, see, Pete goes the family route.
Yeah.
I'm a little more cynical.
Yeah, he's dusting right now. He hits the weight bench out in the garage.
Dust it off. Yeah, what's the over-under on when we hear the stories? He's gathered an exploratory committee. It's
right.
Coming at you.
I like to see Paul Ryan, the Little League coach, now that he's got that time. I'd like to see him there. And it, just his luck, he'll be so like that. He'll get the Pirates, you know, that'll be his team. And then the team that's the Angels will be the bully, dad, big, boisterous, just uses Twitter all day. That's who his nemesis coach will be. He'll be right back.
Right back.
I tried to get out of this.
Yeah, the Little League team sponsored by the SEIU. Union proud team, pal.
They're all going to line up to challenge him in Little League. That's what's going to happen. Yeah, I wonder. I haven't talked to anybody. I'd love to get some people on from Wisconsin to see what they think about that. Because there's something. Even though there will be many in the opposition party that will be happy with the results, there is some pride in the fact that a sitting congressman from Janesville, Wisconsin, is the Speaker of the House of Representatives. So Wisconsin will lose that. So that would be the angle I would go with.
Remember how proud we were with Hastert?
Yeah, I guess so.
Wheels fell off that bus, didn't it?
You gotta look back. You gotta really dig deep on that pride. Huh. Was I proud? Yeah. So, anyway, yeah. So we'll see what this means. Maybe a chance to. Does Roskam? I know his name was thrown about when the speaker's Boehner was stepping down before.
Yeah, because he was pretty. I mean, he was like. Minority whip, maybe? Something
like that.
He had
some leadership, and I wonder if he would be considered to for that position. I don't know. I mean, he has to
Kinziger.
Win.
Where's he at in the pecking
another
order?
One. I mean, there are some strong.
Kinziger also, pretty buff. You know, he could fit the. He'd step right in for Paul Ryan.
He'd win a lot of votes with his workout regime.
Yeah.
Hey, you got Kinziger and Roskam, both are congressional Republicans that have strong standing in the House, so it would be interesting to see.
Roskam whines too much. He's very whiny.
I wonder, the big knock on him, I always see the papers doing stories how he won't do the town forums. You know, a couple months ago, everyone would do town forums, and it was just a... It was delve into chaos as people are yelling at their representatives. Well, he refuses to do them. And there's a lot of people in his district that find that to be unacceptable, that he doesn't actually meet with constituents. And I don't know if he's been held to that or if he talks about it, but it might be that he's just like, I know what's going to happen. You know, I kind of see where their job is to meet with constituents. So, I'm sorry, that's hard.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, holding a town forum, they usually get hijacked.
Yeah.
And then it becomes a shouting match and a screaming match. And anyone who's been in any of those.
And I think that's what he says, too. It's counterproductive. It's counterproductive.
So, because I could see him. But again, that doesn't give you, you can't just not meet with constituents.
Well, but then you walk away. I mean, if that's what happens,
right.
All right, I'm done. But, you know, at least get there.
Right. Agreed.
What about a good old suggestion box?
Yeah. Just
pop one in there.
Right by the statue.
Yeah.
In the 6th district.
Read those and then...
Right. Yeah. All right. I think we fixed it. All right. Coming up, our monthly installment of Writing Out Loud. It used to be called Tell Me Your Story, but we've changed it to Writing Out Loud. This is Beth Vinke's segment. She comes in with us, and she brings in one. She teaches a class to seniors to teach them how to write their memoir, and she brings some of her students in to tell their stories. Writing out loud, I love it. It really, people come in tonight, no exception. We'll learn more from one of Beth's students and Writing Out Loud, which is coming up next. So stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up a little bit later, we're going to talk about high-end audio equipment. The Expona Expo is coming to Schaumburg this weekend. And I've been reading the little ads for it throughout the month. But I'm so interested in finding out more about what people are doing when it comes to speaker systems and stereos and everything in this day and age, in 2018. Is it the same? I mean, is it the same when you would have the receiver and the stereo and you'd have to plug in the cassette player and the DVD and the CD? And
no, it's not the same.
It's not the same anywhere?
No.
No. And I want to know what is being done in 2018 when it comes to digital music. So we'll have some reps from the Expo coming up here later in the 9 o'clock hour. Well, it's time for another installment of our new monthly segment called Writing Out Loud. We did call it Tell Me Your Story, but we've changed it to Writing Out Loud. Author and journalist Beth Finke teaches a memoir writing class to seniors through the city. She's been doing it for years. The goal is to get her students comfortable in writing down their life experience, their story. Last month, we met Bob Eisenberg, who worked down at Maxwell Street as a kid. And tonight, Beth is back with another student and a teacher herself, Audrey Mitchell. Audrey teaches a memoir writing class on the southwest side of Chicago at the Ashburn Public Library, and she got interested in telling her own story after she traced her family's history and realized she wanted to know more about her long-lost relatives, so she's writing her story down to share with future generations. Beth Finke, the author of several books, including Writing Out Loud, What a Blind Teacher Learned from Leading a Memoir Class for Seniors, and Audrey Mitchell, welcome to The Download.
Thanks for having me.
Good to see you, Beth. Okay, so let's first remind people this concept. You've been teaching a memoir class, and as a woman who is visually impaired, blind, mm-hmm. you've changed the way that you would have to teach this class, and that has had students get up on their feet, and they have to actually explain their story or tell their story as opposed to just writing it down.
That's right. Well, they write their stories, but then they read that out loud, and they don't stand up. I don't make them stand. I'm looking at Audrey. Most of them don't stand up.
Are you thinking in your head right now? You're like, oh, maybe that's a new wrinkle Justin just gave me. Yeah.
No, I think, you know, I have had some people come to class who are really afraid of public speaking. And I don't think I say in the description that you have to read out loud. Yeah, I don't think so. So people come to the class the first time, and when I explain, well, I can't see, so none of you guys get to read your story. You know, you don't get to see the paper and read along when somebody's listening. So we all have to listen. And it's turned out to be a good thing, I think. Do you think?
Yeah, but sometimes some people stand up because there's one person in the class who's hard of hearing. And
you have to project, right?
Yes, and we supply her with a copy of our essays.
If you wear a hearing aid, you get to have a copy. But only if you wear a hearing aid.
But if someone doesn't have a copy, then they walk over by her and stand next to her.
What? And, I didn't know.
Yes, they do.
You didn't know that?
Oh.
Tell me about that. Really, that's true.
I mean, you don't hear the voice reflection when they're talking.
Well, they're not across the room.
And she sits right next to one. That is hilarious.
These students, you got to watch out. They're hijinks and shenanigans. Audrey, what made you interested first off in taking Beth's class, but then also making that transition to teaching it yourself?
Well, specifically with my relatives, I did my genealogy, and there were no stories written down. All there was oral history. And I thought that, you know, I should have something in writing so I can hear their voice. So I decided that not only would I write their stories from the oral history, but I would write my story. And I've been in best class since 2009, and I think I had enough experience in the class to lead a class of my own, which was what I was looking for initially, a class in my own area. But I found one at the Renaissance Center downtown.
And that's at the Chicago Cultural Center.
Right.
And so I decided to start my own class with Beth's blessing.
Yes.
And I use her format. And I started off in 2014 with two or three students, maybe three or four, and now there's about 12 strong.
Oh, that's great.
And most of them are repeats.
Okay. So a lot of I've noticed that, Beth. You do get a lot of repeats, people who will stay with the class and continue with the class. Why do you think that is? I mean, if you're teaching them how to write their own story, should they be done after the how many weeks that you do the class, or why do you think they stick around?
Can I answer that?
Sure.
Because it's easy. There's no pressure. She lets us write our story, and she doesn't criticize us. There's no critique. And some people who have been to my class, they wanted a critique, so they left. But I wasn't going to give them a critique. But that's
why don't you give them a critique?
We don't need to because it's their voice. I mean, we're not going to change what they say around.
Mm-hmm.
So
you're just going to give them structure on how to get that story
just
out.
Just say it. If you can write a note, if you can write an email, if you can write a letter, you can write an essay.
The last two students that were in, you know, we started the conversation by asking about, you know, the insecurity of thinking if you can write your own story.
Mm-hmm.
This concept of, well, you know, do I really have a story to tell? Do you feel that way?
Well, we give them a topic. And we give them a few little guidelines with the topic, mm-hmm. and then they would go from there. But when someone new comes to my class, the first day of class, I will tell them, okay, I'll give them the topic for next week. And then I'll say, write down five words or five phrases or five sentences about this topic. And we give them 5 or 10 minutes to do that. And then afterwards, everybody reads theirs, and when they read it, I said, that's your story.
When you first took Beth's class back in 2009, did you feel like you had a story to tell, or did the class pull it out of you?
Well, I had been writing some things myself because I had read this book. I forgot the author's name, but she lived in an area that was right next to my area. And she wrote about things that I was familiar with. And I saw her, what she had written. I mean, mine's not to be published. Just is only for my own use or for my descendants and whatnot. And I said, well, I can do that. I can write about this store. I can write about this movie house and things like that. So I just kind of filled up a book with this information in it. And then I told my sister about it. And she says, oh, they've got a memoir writing class down at Renaissance Court. So that's when I joined.
That's when you got in.
I tried 3 times to get in, and it was so popular that I finally got in.
So. Well, there's a lot of people repeat, you know.
Right.
So yeah. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, let's do this. We'll take a break and come back, and then I want to ask you about what you learned from genealogy. Talk a little bit about your story. Learn more about Audrey's story. The segment's called Writing Out Loud. Which is based on Beth Finke's book, Writing Out Loud, What a Blind Teacher Learned from Leading a Memoir Class for Seniors. We'll take a quick break, and we'll come back and learn more about Audrey. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. The Download, 720 WGN. I am Justin Kopp, and Beth Finke is in studio with our segment, Writing Out Loud, based on her book, Writing Out Loud, What a Blind Teacher Learned from Leading a Memoir Class for Seniors. One of her students who has turned into a teacher as well is Audrey Mitchell. Audrey teaches a memoir writing class in the southwest side of Chicago at the Ashburn Public Library. And as we mentioned, Audrey, you got interested in telling your story because you traced your genealogy. What'd you find?
Well, first of all, it was oral history. And I was able to go back to, let's say, my great-grandfather on my mother's side. So after I got his name and the information on him, I was able to find out, you know, his offspring and not necessarily oral history, but through the census records and things of that nature. And also recently I found out who possibly was his slave master. I'm a member of the Old Edgeville District Genealogy Society, and what happens is that they send me a newsletter quarterly.
Wow.
And there was a doctor who they profiled in there, and they found his journal, and the most important thing they pointed out in his journal was that he named his slaves, he wrote his slave's name on the last page and their birth date. And
you were able to see
several of those names were familiar to me. In fact, they were my great grandfather, his sister, and his brother.
That moment when you were able to discover that, how, take us there. What was the emotion like?
Well, it was after I had really finished my genealogy project for that particular faction of the family, and I was wondering, you know, who were their slave owners, and when I found that information, now it. That's not the only thing that I found, because in the 1870 and the 1880 census, those were the first censuses where they named everyone by their first and last name,
right,
and had their families. The doctor lived in close proximity with my grandfather and his sister, right?
Wow.
His sister and brother. So therefore, that was more evidence that there was a attachment to them. And so since then, I have not been able to prove that information, but I can assume that that's the situation.
Your parents mm-hmm. came from South Carolina, right. came here during the Great Migration.
Right. My father came first, and then my mother came a few years later, but they both came in the 1920s.
And they weren't married before
they
that.
They didn't know each other, right?
No, they knew each other, but they weren't married. They weren't
married.
In fact, each of them lived with cousins because that's why they were enticed to Chicago versus going to the East Coast where most of our other relatives went. And they, you know, courted a lot and like that. In fact, one of my family friends told me that he wanted to court my mother, but she said she was waiting on my father. And they did not get married until she was 35 and he was 38.
Wow, that's old. Yeah.
So you're lucky to know me.
We are, yes, in so many ways.
Do you talk about your upbringing? Talk about growing up in Chicago. Where'd you grow up?
Well, I grew up in the area what we call Bronzeville now. When I was growing up, it was called Grand Boulevard. Mm-hmm. It was basically an African-American community, but everybody lived there. They lived together. In other words, people who were poor and on welfare or people who were working or people, teachers or professionals, doctors, lawyers, they all lived in the same area. And it was pretty, it had stores. I mean, you didn't necessarily have to go downtown. Have you ever heard of the South Center? Or, you know, that was a large department store that was in the area. And it was right near King Drive, which is, at the time, was called South Parkway. And that, I think that's why it was called Grand Boulevard.
And what years would this be?
This was in the late 1940s and 1950s.
Okay, interesting time for Chicago, mm-hmm. on the south side of Chicago.
Right.
You lived a life in Chicago, and one of the, as we sort of bounce around your life, and one of the mm-hmm. things I thought we could talk about was just your education, because you went to Roosevelt University.
I
at
did.
At a mature age.
Right.
Talk about that.
Well, what happened, I did get married, and so I raised my family, and I
soon out of high school you got married.
Yes, and I wanted mm-hmm. to go to college, of course, but, you know, you're busy with your life. And so I read this book, A Color of Water, by James McBride. And his mother had 12 children, and all of them went to school, got college degrees, some advanced degrees, doctors, etc. And then after they finished, she went to school at age 68 and became a social worker. And I said, well, you're never too old to go to school. So at age 50, I got a new job, and I was thinking about going to school because of the book, and they had a tuition reimbursement program. So, I mean, I had to take advantage of that. And so it took me about 10 years.
I was going to say, was it hard? I always wonder, was it hard?
No, it was easy. It was much easier. I took an entrance exam and aced it. And then I graduated I had the gold tassel with the, you know, I graduated with honors.
Of course.
So, but I don't think that I would have done
that. You wouldn't have done that if you were, yeah.
Right.
And, mm-hmm. and I guess emotionally or mentally, do you have to prepare yourself for a lot of times, you know, if you're mm-hmm. 19 years old and you mm-hmm. go to school, you know it's a four-year deal and you're going to try to, oh, if I can just get this done, I'm going to. Mm-hmm. In the case you know you're going part-time and you're going at an older age and you know it's going to be a longer cycle, mm-hmm. are there mental moments where you're like, why am I doing this?
Not really, because it went by so fast. I mean, I was kind of shocked when it was over. I said, already? As well as I had a lot of peers, too, you know, who were doing this, were around my age. Well, they were younger than I was, you know, they were adults. Mm-hmm. So it was mostly adult study. So, but it went by fast. I was just amazed. In 2003, I got my diploma.
Well, congratulations.
Yes, thank you.
You know, when you look back on that, what did that experience do to enrich your life?
Well, it just made me I always said that on my tombstone, it would be Audrey Mitchell, B.A. So, and it did help with the job advancement, too.
It did.
So, yes.
Audrey, you know, when you have the ability to not only trace your ancestry and have some pretty explosive revelations, even if you can't prove it, but the idea that it's there, and then also have these moments in your life, like going to school at an older age, does that become the tentpoles when you think about your life as a story? Do you think that's chapter 5, that's chapter 9, that's chapter 12? Do you see when you're writing your memoir where these different things fit in?
Oh, in a way I do, but basically, Beth and myself, we give topics to write about. And so we write specifically about the topics, and then sometimes the topics overlap, like you're writing about pets, or you're writing about school, or you're writing about children or whatnot, so you can bunch them together.
Right.
So it's not a matter where you would pull something out and say, well, let me just write about this. You can write about a topic of your own. Choice, but it's easier to do it Beth's way.
When you gather yours together, is there one topic that you've written a lot about? I mean, it does.
Basically, my daughter, maybe.
Yeah.
I might have written a lot of things about her. And then gardening, too. That's another thing, which I miss because I live in a condo now.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yes. I'm with you. All right, last question. And this, I'm just going scrolling over the life experience that Beth gave me in two sentences. But she said that after school, you would go join the live filmings, the tapings of Soul Train. is that true? You would go do Soul Train tapings as a kid?
Unfortunately, it didn't get that serious. But I will tell you that I was a big fan of Soul Train. And it was just, I would, Saturdays it came on at 12 noon. If I had something to do Saturday, I'd make sure that I was home at 12 noon.
Absolutely.
To watch Soul Train. I mean, those kids could dance.
Did you ever consider maybe a career in dance? Audrey okay. Mitchell, a student and a teacher as well. She teaches a memoir class down at the Ashburn Public Library in Chicago's Southwest Side. Beth Finke, the author of Writing Out Loud, What a Blind Teacher Learned from Leading a Memoir Class for Seniors, which is also the name of this segment. We had Tell Your Own Story, but that doesn't roll off the tongue as well as Writing Out Loud. So thanks for letting us borrow the name.
Thanks for borrowing it.
Beth, you know, for you, you're not teaching right now. You got some events coming up, but you're bringing the class back in May.
Yes, it's coming back together in May.
May 2nd.
And if you want to learn more about it, look at BethFinke.com.
There you go, Beth Finke and Audrey Mitchell. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
This is Download 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Greg Flam will be here at DuPage Picker. We'll do the swap meet. This is, of course, where we evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk. 312-981-7200. The best brag tonight gets a pizza. That's what I'm saying. Like, and last week we had some really good stuff, and the week before, someone called in and had the VHS tape of Stephen Gary's New Year's Eve celebration. That's a great. I was like, that's great. And I can't remember what we had. The cufflinks of Dan Rostenkowski, that one. And there's every week. If you have a good Chicago brag, if you've got good collectibles or memorabilia, now's the time to call because you can get a free pizza. 312-981-7200. That's coming up at 10 o'clock. Well, we've been talking about the Expona Audio Expo all month long. It's coming up this weekend at the Schaumburg Convention Center. And this year is the biggest expo yet. It features the latest in high-end audio equipment. It also presents seminars for audiophiles and music lovers. And it even has its own concerts and a vinyl record fair. This is an interesting area because we all know that one friend who spent a ton of time, energy, and resources building the best stereo they could. But with technology, digital music, I'm thinking Bluetooth, what are the best products and overall practices to get the best from your music today in 2018? Joining me in studio, Liz Miller. She's the event director at Expona. Liz, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Bess Nivera, he is the brand ambassador at Music Direct, the world's largest online retailer of high-end audio and accessories located right here in Chicago. Music Direct will be at the expo this weekend. Thanks for being here, Bess.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Also, a weekend, a legend in the sense that you've been at WDCB doing jazz programming on the weekend for 20-plus years, but
please,
that's a different
life. Please pardon me while I blush brutally on air here.
Well, let's first, Liz, let's talk with you. I mean, I said at the beginning, this is the biggest to date because the exhibitors have doubled. You've had so much success in getting people to come to the Schaumburg Convention Center. Talk about the success, overall success of this expo.
It's the largest show we've had to date. So part of the experience of the show is going to different listening rooms. So you can audition and check out all of the different sound systems. And this year we're going to have 165 different listening rooms. So you can check out 165 different sound systems and go from room to room.
Who comes to this? I mean, is this something where it's just people who are super into stereos?
It's people who are super into stereos. It's audiophiles, but it's also for music lovers. It's for anyone who wants to learn about listening to their music, how to find new gear. It's really for music lovers.
And all overall, the idea of putting together concerts and a record fair and all the stuff that goes around it, that's a little bit of a newer experience. Why do that? Why not just make this an expo that you have seminars and let the audiophiles wrestle over the latest technology?
Well, we bring in the concerts because I think after listening to, you know, sound reproduction all day, it's great to at night then celebrate like live music. And that's also a way to, again, like add to that experience and just love music. Yeah.
Bess, let's bring you in here. We'll talk about your role at Music Direct, but then we'll do another half hour just on what you do and jazz on the weekends. But for you, you're a long time. Music Direct's been a big part of the exhibit, but the expo, but also you as an audiophile and someone who works at this stuff. What does an expo like this mean for you here in the city of Chicago?
Well, there's certainly two elements to it. Number one, as a one of the primary exhibitors for it for Music Direct here in Chicago, it certainly brings our fan base to our backyard. Chicago has been our home for more than 2.5-3 decades now, and it certainly serves a purpose for our customers and fans of the industry and lovers of music and high-quality audio to come to an event space like the Schaumburg Convention Center and Hotel to just be immersed by the newest equipment, the newest speakers, the best technology, headphones, digital media.
Do you have to have an expo like this in the world, in the audiophile world? Because otherwise, there's so many different... I mean, the day and age of going into the brick and mortar has gone to online. I mean, even Music Direct is an online retailer. Do you have to have these experiences where people can get together, share an experience in a listening room, that kind of thing?
Well, it certainly has gotten to that point, but I think we should argue back to the days when the Consumer Electronics Show first landed its shores here in Chicago back in the day, and how that has morphed into a more sort of generalized industry. Our segment, which covers what should be defined as high-performance audio, basically covers the tenets of the audiophile buying public. These are people or consumers who are very, very intent on getting the best sound that they can grab out of that favorite tune that they're playing, whether it's in traditional media like turntables and vinyl to more high-performance streaming technologies, whether it's pay services like Tidal and the like, where those consumers can hear it on the highest quality equipment. But we should also point out that it's not so much the audiophile that events like Expona is purveying to. It's actually more towards consumers who are looking for a unique escape, a way to say, oh, so that Melody Gardot record really sounded that awesome on that record, or if somebody had a Jack White record or whatnot, to really just lay the groundwork of what it should sound like in their mind. And
there have been different times in the history of high-end audio equipment and this movement where it is broken into the mainstream, where you've had that has been the advertising. I think of the guy who's in the chair, the Dolby chair, or the Maxell or whatever. You know what I'm talking about.
Like
the concept that high-end audio was trying to be was being pushed, and the idea that's the only way to listen to music. Has that changed? I mean,
well, it certainly has changed in the sense that, as you said, about an hour ago, as I was driving in from my home, in which, what am I going to do with those really large loudspeakers? And I think in that scenario, and as also ascribed in that fantastic iconic portrait of the guy with his hair blowing back and the JBL loudspeakers in the picture, that audio is still that. Okay. And but what's more important about it is that the refinement of that experience is still just as mind-blowing when somebody sits in a room and listens to a favorite record of theirs, whether it's classical or otherwise. The equipment that's going to be demonstrated at Expona runs the gamut from your unusually small and ridiculously budget-priced but yet powerful design to the state-of-the-art speakers that will take up a room and just, like, shock the daylights out of you.
I just wonder, because I think about some of the products even today in 2018 that have been introduced, whether it be the smart, the home speakers, or I think about the headphones, like the Beats by Dre is a good example of this marketing that these are better than the other headphones. These are, you're going to hear what the baseline, you're going to hear it more than other ones. As someone who is immersed in this stuff, is that true?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, let's face it. When someone is marketing a product like Beats and other high-performance headphones, Bose or otherwise, for all intents and purposes, they are very good headphones. And just like any other product that's out there, it's designed by someone or a group of people to make sure that what you hear is as good as they put it out there to be. But at the same token, there is that defined population, that group of audiophiles, that group of music lovers who look for something higher, something more truthful, something more accurate. And that's why in the case of what you'll hear at Expona this weekend, headphone manufacturers from around the world, including great companies like Sennheiser, Shure, which is based here in Illinois, as you know, and also upstart companies, including a fantastic design of headphones from Dan Kelly, a company called Mr. Speakers, a European company called Meza. The list goes on and on, and that's just headphones.
Wow, that's amazing. Beth Nivera is in studio, the brand ambassador with Music Direct, which is right here in Chicago, the world's largest online retailer of high-end audio and accessories. Also, Liz Miller, she's the event director at Expona. The Expona Audio Expo is this weekend, starts on the 12th tomorrow, and runs through the weekend at the Schaumburg Convention Center. We'll take a quick break, come back, continue the conversation. Stay with us. Download 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman. We're talking about the Expona Audio Expo, which is coming up starting tomorrow at the Schaumburg Convention Center. In studio, Liz Miller. She's the event director at Expona. And Beth Nivera, who's the brand ambassador with Music Direct, as well as a weekend disc jockey over at WDCB Jazz. Great station. I know a lot of people work there. Dan, say hi to Dan for me.
You just said it.
There it is, right? Liz, as we were talking about attracting a community of audiophiles, people who are really into high-end audio and the equipment that you can purchase for high-end audio experiences, you're going to get them to come together because it's a community. But how do you get the fringe? How do you get guys like me who will go to Best Buy and be like, yeah, I guess I need a speaker, and you know, and don't really think about it? How do you market and get that demographic, the more passive audio fan, to come out to a expo like this?
A few different ways. Like, part of it is talking about the experience. So you're not... Part of Expona isn't necessarily even about buying. It's about going and experiencing music and listening to all different kinds of songs and comparing. And then another big part of it is the event features that we have, like the record fair, because vinyl's back. It's big. People are getting back into collecting records. So by having this record fair at the show, it brings in people. And the concerts, too. Like, that's a big part of it, because that's something that people relate to. They know that experience. They get excited about that. So then they come out to the show.
Beth, let me ask you this simple question. Digital music, better or worse?
Silence. Chuck Woolery.
I would think that it would be better, only because they don't have to press it. They have a way of controlling the how it's produced.
There's two camps to that,
okay.
Unfortunately. Well, fortunately and unfortunately. It depends on the mindset of the individual. When the emergence of the compact disc back in 1983 set the world on fire and ushered in the so-called first death of vinyl, I think the message there was, it's an accurate format. People find it very convenient. It's very enjoyable, very musical. Whereas more purists could see through the thing, you know, the lining, and say, well, yeah, but fast forward to now where we are with streaming, with content providers like Tidal, as we said earlier in the segment. They have taken great pains to, for a reasonable subscription model, to give those consumers virtually bit-perfect recordings of things that they want to hear.
Right.
So if it's the latest release, be it in every segment of the territory from rap to jazz, or even spoken word, there are instances where that kind of content delivery is great. But what you're going to find in events like Axpona is that the convergence of digital and analog has gotten bigger and better. Analog lovers who will go down to listen to a turntable, whether it's a basic, say, $300 entry-level piece, mm-hmm. to the sky's the limit $50,000 to $100,000 rig, will be more than impressed by the way that it delivers that music. So going back to the Melody Gardot piece, for example, she's got a great voice. She carries very well. She's almost to the point of seduction. And if you can hear that on anything from a very basic stereo system to the more formidable big setups, you will find yourself saying, okay, I get it. And that's the message. And I think that goes to the heart of what Liz said earlier, and that Axpona is treated in several other ways, in my opinion. It's educational, it's informative, but above all, it's entertaining, where dealers, manufacturers come and take you by the hand physically and go, have a seat.
And that has to be part of it, only because I'll just speak for myself. I'm intimidated by the whole thing. I am in radio, have been in life. I've done a lot of audio. I have a lot of, when I come across an audio file, quickly they will be like, oh, did you change the setting? What are you working in? And I'm like, oh, man, I don't know. But far too often in those kind of situations, I'll step away, or I find myself intimidated because I don't know the best rig. I don't know if I'm being taken advantage of. So tell me, how do you get past that? Because I feel like as an industry, at Music Direct and other places, that you have to probably deal with that a lot.
Well, you're absolutely right, and this is not typical of any dealer, whether it's the small dealers here in Chicago, including Saturday Audio Exchange, Audio Consultants, the little guys. Everybody has to work very hard to make sure that when a customer comes into their shop, or in this case comes to Axpona, they're not intimidated. They need to feel more relaxed and more comfortable. And our goal in our industry is to make sure that you get the best possible care in what it is that you're really looking for. So even if you're not the big audiophile guy, you probably sit there and go, hey, Alexa, would you please?
Yeah, right.
And we dig that. And there's nothing wrong with that. But we can also say, why don't you take your Alexa experience, and while you're listening to that online station, slap it into this really, really gorgeous, simple two-speaker compact package, and it's Bluetooth, and it's also capable with full app streaming. You'll get all that, but the critical difference there is what's inside those boxes. And a company, for example, like Kef out of Great Britain, they designed a pair of wireless loudspeakers that are one of the most accurate loudspeakers you can get for the money.
That's going to be the difference here. When we talk about digital music, especially streaming and MP3s and everything that Apple Music or Spotify, far too often, and I'm guilty of this as well, I'm more enamored with the fact that I could just press play on my phone and or say out loud in my room, play this song. I don't care how it's being played. I'm just excited that I can play it. And at some point, they're going to catch up and say, well, you got to bring back the same tenets that once existed of building the stereo system are still in play.
Well, we are living in a digital world. Let's be real about this. We're always looking at things from a tactile kind of way. If I can swipe, touch, feel, speak, ask it to do stuff, fabulous. We're living the dream on that. But along the way, we still have to remind ourselves that when we do walk into that traditional record store and you're flipping the piles and you're kind of going, oh my gosh, Ramsey Lewis, things like that,
right.
You do get that sort of return to sensory comfort. And that's where products like speakers, amplifiers, and so on and so forth, to show your sense of nostalgia, going back to the large loudspeaker, one of the things that Music Direct will be doing as part of its presentations is that we're going to be showing off a speaker that's been not on the shelves for nearly 40 years. The brand is JBL, well-known for our work in radio, mm-hmm. as you know. Mm-hmm. It's monitors and so forth. Yeah. But they are bringing to the show the iconic L100 loudspeaker. And this is a loudspeaker that you saw in that very ad for that cassette tape. And it's been completely refashioned.
Awesome.
It's been completely redesigned by a great bunch of people over there at JBL over in Northridge, California. And it's going to be played loud.
That's great.
It's going to be kicking.
Liz, with only a minute left here, what do you see as the highlights? What are you looking forward to at the Axpona this weekend?
I'm just really looking forward to going from room to room and listening to some of my favorite music and just discovering it again.
Are you someone who sits down at the seminars and listens to the audio files, get up there and be like, the great thing about this speaker?
Well, I put together the seminars, but usually I'm running around too much make it happen. But, you know, we try to do different things with the seminars. Like, we've got, like, some interior designers talking about how to design your room and stuff like that. So we're trying not to be quite so technical and kind of bring it somewhere else.
And that's the one part that we're not going to get to tonight, but the idea of building that room. You know, I found myself, you know, in awe of all my neighbors when they can press play and the speaker comes from somewhere in the house. And you're like, where is that coming? That's amazing. That's in the wall? Wow. Yeah, I've not gotten there in my life, so I'm sure you're there. Liz Miller is the event director for Expona. The Expona Audio Expo starts tomorrow at the Schaumburg Convention Center, runs through Sunday. And also, Bess Nivera is the brand ambassador with Music Direct, the world's largest online retailer of high-end audio and accessories, also a partner with Expona, and they're located right here in Chicago. Bess, Liz, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Or it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
Here we are.
That's right. It's time for another edition of Swap Meets. This, of course, our segment where we evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk, 312-981-7200. And if you got something you want to brag about and you think it's the best brag of the night, I'm going to give you a pizza.
Awesome.
No big deal. How you been?
Lou Malnati's. Love it.
Yeah.
Good day. I spent the morning in Winfield. State sale, and while I was there, I hit four or five antique shops and really nice people and some interesting stuff.
You know? I was going to say, this really is the beginning of, you get a nice day like this, will you start to see in the next couple weeks here the season stuff?
I'm willing to bet tomorrow there'll be some garage sales, because it's going to be really nice tomorrow, and people know the weekend's not going to be so nice, so I think people might do a one-day sale tomorrow.
Where, is there a place you go online to find out garage
sales? Yeah, there's
are you a troll? You just
yeah, there's
around?
A free app called gsailor.com, and it's spelled G-S-A-L-R. They leave out whatever the blanket on whatever my English. But anyways, gsailor.com, and it's a free app. It will flag where there's sales. It will give you directions. If you tap on it and just say directions, it will help you route. And, you know, the best thing to do is look for, like, a subdivision that's having a sale, so you can kill a lot of birds at once. So
I just have a mental image in my head of you just driving around, subdivision.
Sometimes
subdivision, just hoping
it's called freestyling
something.
In the world of...
no, they got a name for it?
Yeah, it's called freestyle. And some days that does happen, and some days that is your best sale, because sometimes you'll hit that sale where they just put the sign out in front of their yard. They did not put it online. They didn't put it anywhere else. So,
right, they went old school.
Yeah, and so you have, like, first pick on a lot of things there.
All right, what'd you bring in tonight?
Well, let's talk about yours. No?
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. All right. If you're watching on the stream, you can probably see it. All right, so what I've got here from my buddy Tommy, who sent this to Chicago. It was kind of a pain in the butt
why he sent
it to me. I'm not even sure why he sent it to me. He knows I like the Bulls. That's about it. It's a Sports Illustrated cover of December 10th, 1984, A Star is Born. It's Michael Jordan with the old Chicago cursive jersey. Mm-hmm. It says Michael Jordan lights up the NBA, and he's jumping over Sidney Moncrief and the Milwaukee Bucks, including, we can't, if that's a Dan Marley or maybe a Scott Skiles.
Yep.
It's someone in short shorts. There's a lot of short shorts.
A lot of shorts going on.
And it's blown up in its frame, so it's blown up.
Yeah, so it's poster size.
Poster size.
Of the cover, which is really cool.
Yeah.
So, December 10th, 1984, by the way.
Would you say priceless on it? Would you say $1,000?
You know, I could not find one currently on eBay.
Right.
So you've got something good here. And it's not torn up. and it's not, like some of your other items, you talked about.
There's no duct tape on the corner.
But yeah, I think it's a great item. I think you could probably start at a $100 auction and see where it goes from there.
Man, I should do it.
There are dozens of, so people aren't confused, there's dozens of the actual magazine size and the magazine itself of Sports Illustrated, but this is a nice size poster.
When I told Tommy, I said, yeah, I'm gonna give it to Greg and we're going to put it on the swap meet. He's like, you're not going to keep it? And I was like, well, what do you want me to do? He's like, oh, I got it because I knew you liked the Bulls. You're not going to, like, he got kind of offended that I was thinking about giving it away.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I thought you'd give away the pizza and keep the poster. Or if you want, I'll sell it for you.
I guess it's so funny because we're moving, right? We need to do an episode of the swap meet from my office. And we'll just pick all the stuff that's in there because there are a bunch of tchotchkes and all this kind of stuff that
there's
we have to
be
get rid of.
Stuff,
yeah, you got
to
come in there before we move next month.
I
so
have to.
The idea, I should be eliminating these things from my office, not adding them.
That's true.
But all right, what do you bring in tonight?
I brought in Nintendo NES, the first version
look
of
at
it.
That
yeah.
Got the Duck Hunt.
It's, the best thing about it is the box is like mint condition. That is just the best money shot there. And it works. Everything's there. All the manuals, all the cables. And if you have all of that in the original plastic wrappers, what they pretty much call near mint condition, you can get like $185 to $230.
Which is what
online.
It would cost it when you bought it.
When you bought it, yeah. So, I mean, but they're getting harder to find. So
the golden question is, do you have to blow in it? You have to.
No, I've repaired it. I know how to do the repairs on that, and I've taken care of that.
You've done that?
Yeah, and they say the reason that worked is the moisture from blowing it at.
That's my favorite thing to do.
Created a better contact with the contacts and the circuit in there.
Hey, you guys want to play Contra? 1 second.
Right, right. Yep. Did it. Been there, done that.
Up, up, down, down, A, B, A, B.
Yeah,
that's a Nintendo move. 312-981-7200. We want to get your texts and calls now. And all right, if you can beat my poster, someone just texted in and said it's probably Jack Sigma. I'm like, oh, if we're going to do this, if we're going to do
Uh-oh.
80s, it doesn't look like Jack Sigma because Sigma was small, was bigger.
Okay.
He's a taller guy. This looks like a little guy.
Might be Mike Dunleavy.
It might be. That's a good one, Pete.
Like the dad?
The dad, senior.
We need the 1984 Milwaukee Bucks for $500.
That, don't give it away yet. I want everyone
right.
to pick their favorite 80s basketball
okay.
players so we can have that tonight.
Right.
If you can beat my awesome poster of Michael Jordan tonight, if you got a better item than my Michael Jordan beating the Milwaukee Bucks Sports Illustrated blown up poster, I'll give you a pizza. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. Swap meet here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman with Greg Flam. You can find him at DuPage Picker both on Facebook and Twitter. And we are ready to get to your calls and texts tonight.
Yep.
Let's start with Tom. Tom, what do you want to brag about, Tom?
Good morning. I have a hardcover book about the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Okay.
It's 1964.
What's it called?
It's called 4 Days, the Historical Record of the Death of President Kennedy.
Okay.
And is it, it's from 1964?
Yeah, it's published in copyright 1964.
Hmm. Okay. Do you know which edition or printing it is?
I would have to say the first.
Okay, yeah, because it will say probably the first page inside there. The good news is there's only one right now for sale. The bad news is it's about $15. But so if you were to sell it, I would, wait till that one's gone. Then you can probably ask a little bit more. But it's just not a home run, I'm sorry to say.
Okay, well, it's been in the family since 64.
Hey, that's all that counts.
Yep.
It's not a home run. It's more like a ground ball to short. But you did make contact. You did make contact,
right.
Tom. That's what matters.
You didn't miss the sign from the third base coach.
Yeah, right. Thanks, Tom. Yeah, that was
yeah,
not,
like
not a good showing for the White Sox today. I think I won't bunt.
Right, maybe not.
708 says I got a 4x4 piece of cardboard with stencil. Used as a ticket voucher for one of four shows the Smashing Pumpkins did at the Double Door in 1995.
That's
awesome.
That's
a good one. That's good.
That is.
Not as good as Michael Jordan's short shorts.
Probably not. No.
Yeah.
But no, it's really good. And, you could be comparable price to your poster, but I don't know if it will beat your poster.
Yeah. I don't have any memorabilia from my Smashing Pumpkins nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm trying to think. I'm like, maybe I had a t-shirt I got from Rose Records.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wouldn't get the t-shirts at the concert. I'd go to the record store and get the knockoffs.
Right.
$5 cheaper.
Yep.
So I might have had that. I might have had a Siamese Dream poster, maybe, ripped off on the edges.
Yep.
But I went to see the Smashing Pumpkins. Remember, XRT announced they were doing a secret show for Siamese Dream at Metro, and they were under a different name.
Okay.
And so we all went down there, took the Dodge Colt from Wonder Lake, parked it.
Nice.
Probably got towed by Lincoln Towing somewhere in there, you know, for parking on Racine. And then stood in line from like 1 o'clock in the afternoon till they did the show. And then, yeah, it was an amazing moment. I still remember them coming out on stage.
That's cool.
Yeah. That's all I got. Yep. All right. Let's keep going. Let's try Ed. Ed, what do you want to brag about?
Yeah, I've got old records, Bing Crosby from Decca Records, Ethel Merman, Mario Lanza, and I have a Al Jolson, four-record souvenir collection.
Wow, there you go. Those are so some what, old names.
What label is the Al Jolson record on?
Oh, you know what, offhand, I...
Yeah, no worries. I'll have Justin fill it in.
Well, I'm trying to figure out how to work into the conversation. So, Ed, you just have a bunch of old records on the shelf?
Yeah.
Just listen to them all by yourself?
Actually, I have listened to some of them.
Some of that music just ain't got the same soul. But I'll take my old-time rock and roll.
There you go.
That's how he started. He said, I got a bunch of old records. So, like, it automatically came in my head. And look at me. I'm a wordsmith.
Did you get your first real six string at a five and dime? That's awesome.
We get old
some
records,
of the Decca label artists can get some decent money, but I'm afraid Bing Crosby, probably not so much. The Al Jolson, I'd be interested in if I knew what label it was on, but there's just so much out there, so it's hard to discern.
That's cool you got him, though.
But it is, yeah. I would... definitely research them before you let them go, if you do let them go.
All right, there you go.
Okay, great.
Thanks,
Ed.
Thanks for calling.
312-981-7200. Still looking for the big brag that is going to beat my Michael Jordan poster.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Jordan lights up the NBA, and I think we've nailed it that it might be the Dunleavy, the dad, who, if it is already in rare form on this poster because he is flopping. As Michael Jordan goes in for the layup, the Dunleavy face is, oh, God, I'm being fouled. That's what he looks like, just like a coach would, you know? Like, he's already got the I'm going to complain that I'm being out-athleted here.
What, didn't he coach the against the Bulls and like maybe their second?
Yeah, like is Portland wasn't like a, he the coach?
Yeah,
in
maybe the Trailblazers.
Maybe that's him. Yeah, I can't tell because the face in this picture is contorted.
Mm-hmm.
He's got that. It looks like he's being kneed in the groin as Jordan whips past him. But from this angle, which is really awesome because you don't know what happened just before or after this play, he's not actually touching Michael Jordan and he's going into I've been fouled so bad. Like, he's just ready for the flop. So that's what I have. What do you have? 312-981-7200. Let's try Mike. Mike, what do you want to brag
about,
Mike?
How you doing, fellas?
Hi there.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you. I've got an original Broadway cast album from Sunday in the Park with George.
Okay.
Signed by Bernadette Peters, Mandy Patinkin, Paul Gemignani, and Stephen Sondheim.
Wow, that's awesome. I like that. Yeah. How'd you get it?
Well, when I was living in New York, a buddy of mine, they were signing in Schubert Alley when that show was up and running originally, and a buddy of mine got it for me for my birthday, and I've had it ever since. Then.
Schubert Alley. Now, I don't know a lot about
this. And then I worked with Paul Gemignani up at Ravinia, and I asked him to put his Hancock on it.
When you say Schubert Alley, that means the side door to the theater, right, where they would come out and there always are people waiting
for
Schubert the
actors. Well, Schubert Alley is like an area that's right there at like 48th and Broadway. That it's like a crossroads pretty much right in front of the Schubert Theater.
Oh, interesting.
I can't put a number on the because it's signed, but just the record itself goes for about $25. So I would say if you do auction it, maybe start at $80 or $100 if you were to sell it. But, it, you know, the story sounds like you want to keep it, so that sounds cool.
Yeah.
I like it.
Sounds good. Right. Thanks for calling.
The Schubert Alley stuff's interesting because I know what he's talking about. I know the area, but the there's if you're in any of the Broadway houses, there's going to be a stage door on the side, and the more savvy autograph people are going to be waiting at that side door. And I know this because I remember my Brian Darcy James, who was on this program and a friend of ours, a download. He plays King George in Hamilton, and he's Shrek, that kind of thing.
Okay.
His sister, Kate, is who I was in comedy with.
Okay.
And she went to visit him when he was the lead in Titanic.
Wow.
And he had to stop her before they walked out the side door, and because she came to see him, and they were going to go to dinner, and he said, I just need to tell you that it's going to be crazy when you walk out this door. It's going to be a lot of people shoving records and pieces, T-shirts
stage
and stuff
bills,
right
that,
at
yeah.
your face. And she's like, what? What are you talking about? And she opened the door. She told me, she's like, I've never seen anything like it. Like people just like physically and aggressively trying to put things on Brian's body. Like they're just like, do this, sign it. And it's just a big free-for-all for the actors of Broadway musicals that come out. So I just wonder about that. Anyway, 312-981-7200. And all right, so we'll take a quick break. We'll get the news with Rob. We'll come back. We've got Matt on the line. We've got Ron. Got a great text that are coming in right now. A lot of good stuff that are trying to beat my cool Michael Jordan in short shorts poster where he's beating the Milwaukee Bucks. Probably for the only time in his career. The Bucks were powerhouses back in the 80s. I can't even finish this sentence. All right. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman
and Greg Flam.
Here we are.
That's right. That DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter, here every Wednesday. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We are trying to get you to brag about your collectibles, your memorabilia. What do you got that can beat my Sports Illustrated poster? It's a poster-sized, blown-up cover of the December 10th, 1984, A Star is Born poster. Michael Jordan lights up the NBA. He's beating Sidney Moncrief and a couple other schlubs from the Milwaukee Bucks. Lots of short shorts on display. The Jordan shorts are, then this is what makes this special, and it is priceless. The Jordan shorts are normal. The Bucks hadn't got the memo yet in 1984. They're still looking like they're playing in 1952.
Mm-hmm.
That is a short short for Moncrief. Moncrief's jumping up, and you're like, oh, yeah. Blinded by the light, Sidney Moncrief.
But isn't it John Stockton will get the award always for the short shorts? Yeah.
Yeah, he went all the way into the 2000s, 1990s. That. All right, so 312-981-7200. We got a ton of stuff here. 773 starts us off, and I would say, Pete Zimmerman, this might be one that rivals the Star is Born poster. It's first by saying, not selling, just bragging. Strong. That's a good way to start this. And it says, first Nike Bo Jackson poster. They didn't think he was going to be a big deal. That's why he's wearing an Aqua Gear wetsuit. It's true. He sent a picture. She sent a picture. He's in an aqua suit holding a surfboard. And it just says, greetings from the pipeline, Nike.
Who didn't think Bo Jackson was going to be a big deal?
Maybe it's before he was... but he came out... What did he do first? He football first?
Auburn, yeah.
Yep.
No, but I mean, this would be after college because I don't think he could be on a poster if he's in college, right?
Right.
So this would have been after, but maybe it was before he was on the Raiders or whatever.
Well, what's weird is, you know, Bo knows everything, and so you would know surfing, of course. So you would think that came out after that whole...
But this is a big deal. This is a poster that actually does well because it's one of the early ones.
It is. It's a good find and a good brag. And opened, it goes for about $130, $150. There's one online now that's mint, never taken out of the plastic, and they're asking $400. So
$400.
Yeah. So I think minimum, if you had one, you're probably in the $150 to $200 range.
Well, he said he's not selling, or she's not selling, because he's just bragging.
Yeah, that's a cool one though.
Yeah, that's good. I like that one. That one's close.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that beats my short shorts Michael Jordan poster.
Right.
It's close, right? Say it's close.
Yeah, it's close.
Let's go to Ron. Ron, what do you want to brag about, Ron?
Good evening, gentlemen. I have some old comics, Robert Crumb comics, first editions. But I have one from the 80s that I bought from Larry's Comics. I don't know if you remember, way up on the north side. And in this issue, it had a story about Trump and how he goes to Robert Crumb's house, and he's it's not a real sexual one, but he's abused by Robert Crumb and his wife. And I have also a Robert Crumb comic. You know, he did the full-size comics, but then he did the half-size comics, which were very, very vulgar.
Okay.
And I can't say the
name. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. But that's interesting, Trump's in it. You always forget that he was a huge celebrity, even in New York City, and was batted around back in the day, too. What do you got on Trump in the
cover? Does it say, like, HUP or HUP on the cover?
I don't have it in front of me.
Okay, because that's really all I'm finding is are different issues with that on the cover. It doesn't say, like, Trump or anything on the cover, but they do list it as a Trump content comic book by Crumb. And the highest ones are about $40. They're anywhere from, like, $18 to $40.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
And what about the small, very...
The smaller ones... I'm seeing
less.
A couple that's here. Right, yeah, they are less. They are like $10.
Let's bring in our economic contributor, Justin.
Yeah.
Those might be less.
Yeah, I am showing some here less, and they're listed as underground comics.
All right. Let me list one more thing, if I may.
Sure.
I came across, back in the 80s, my dad bought a little cottage in Michigan, and there was one room in there. It had to be a kid's room, and it was like the kid got up and walked away. He had baseball cards. He thumbtacked them to the wall. I can only remember two names. One was Fred Fitzsimmons, and the other, not real big, the other guy was a Pepitone.
Pitcher, yeah.
I believe his ancestors had a Pontiac a dealership in Chicago.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember that.
And right. Also what he left behind was like a collection of, these were dime store toy soldiers. But one of them, I go to toy soldier shows occasionally, and there's a Patton on a little star-spangled podium with his two pearl-handled pistols, four stars on his helmet. And I only saw one at a toy soldier show, and it was a replica. And I only heard of one in England, and it was selling for like $400 like 20 years ago.
When you mean a toy soldier convention, are you talking about like the stuff that would be like the painted ones? Or what do you mean toy soldier? Like, is that what you're talking about? Like the
yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, but these were sold in dime stores. And to see what's unique about these was, I'm sure they had to be, well, if it was patent, it had to be done during World War II. Huh. And most of that stuff was melted down for war material.
Yeah, right.
And so the stuff that I have is, it's pretty rare.
Right.
But especially the patent one.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Thanks, Ron. Appreciate it, man.
You're welcome.
As far as the toy soldier, yeah, there's conventions just specifically on toy soldiers.
The pewter, or the metal ones that are painted and stuff like
there's
that.
There's metal, and then, yeah, even the plastic ones, yeah. Yeah, but that's pretty cool. The Pepitone card, as high as $440 if it's graded mint.
But it's not
Fitzsimmons.
I
couldn't find. Yeah, with the thumbtack, you're
right when he said they were thumbtacked. I'm like, next.
Yeah.
See, I'm learning.
Yeah.
I'm getting all crusty on the edges. Thanks to you. Thanks to you. Greg.
Yeah, I jaded you.
Oh God. Oh, thumbtack.
Yeah.
847 says, I got a 1994 game-worn road gray with cursive Chicago on the front. Frank Thomas baseball jersey. There's a strike-shortened season, and Frank leading Triple Crown at the time of the strike. We know.
Yeah.
He was also named AL MVP, obtained from team two letters of authenticity, jersey signed by Big Frank himself. Any idea on the price of that? Wow.
Yeah, that's amazing, and I'm probably not going to be able to give
you know what? I would rather have signed price. The Big Frank commercial where he's at the airport right now, and the women are like, is that Frank Thomas? That Frank?
Yeah.
He's like, hey, ladies, I'm working out. Like, whatever's about a protein. And what is that? And, anyway, I digress. Yeah. That's got to be worth it.
The ladies like it, too, from what I've heard.
Yeah, that's what it is. That's what he said.
Right. And
so weird.
I mean, just like a signed jersey in general is about 900 to 1,000. And so what he has, you know, could be better more than that.
Because of the year.
Yeah, and the how he got it, and he's got the certificates and so forth.
We were robbed.
Yeah, that was
hopefully
a tough
year. They got a better contract. Everybody got a better contract in labor, but fans were robbed. That was the year the White Sox were going to win it.
It was a great team, the Jeff Torborg years.
Yeah. Oh, Torborg years. All right. 847 says, I have a World War II German Mother's Cross.
There we go.
A medal given to mothers who had three or more kids during the war.
Mm-hmm.
He or she got it from the grandmother when she passed. Yeah. Wow.
That, from looking up, depends how complete it is. Like, does it have the box, you know, the other items? Anywhere from $30 to $200 is what you're kind of looking at there.
I like that one.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Well, when she says who had three or more kids during the war, she mean gave birth to or had three or more kids in the war?
I would guess three of her children in the war, I guess.
Yeah, right? Congratulations, during wartime, you've given birth to three kids. Or is it congratulations, right. Your kids are at war.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, is it more morose with saying three of your kids died? Like, Private Ryan type thing.
Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah, wow. It changes the value of that thing, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
All right. 262 says they've got a autographed Sgt. Pepper's album that I got in 1983, autographed by the three surviving Beatles in an effort to raise money for the National Coalition to Ban Handguns. I acquired it at Beatle Fest. It was organized by Harry Nilsson. Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty rare. I don't know if I can give a value on that.
One of 20.
I would think 20 is, you know, that being one of 20 is going to bring down the value a little bit.
Oh, really? It's got to be.
But, let's see.
That's amazing. That's really great. Just, I mean, obviously it was raising money for gun control measures after John Lennon was killed.
Yeah, it's hard to put a value on that.
Did you see McCartney at the March for Lives?
Yeah, the march,
he said?
Yeah, just hanging out.
He said, my best friend was killed by gun violence. That's what he said about John Lennon. You're like, about that, right?
Yeah.
But more importantly, the idea that you have a signed Sgt. Pepper's album, you have...
I mean, to give you an idea, someone supposedly has all four band members signed, and they're asking $300,000 for it. And that's asking, not sold.
Wow.
So...
That's too much money. that's a new name of the segment. The spin-off segment on Thursdays, that's too much money.
Yeah. Those are items that are used for money laundering.
right.
Like the Beanie Babies that go for $4,000.
Yeah, exactly. Greg Flam in studio. All right, we got a full lineup of calls. What we'll do, we'll take our last break. We'll come back. We'll do rapid fire. Sound good?
Sound good.
Sound good. Stay with us. Wrapping it up, 312-981-7200. Greg Flam's here at DuPage Picker. Let's go to Matt. Matt's been waiting the longest. Matt, what do you want to brag about, Matt?
I've got a couple pieces of 12-inch vinyl here that are unopened. They're the original copies. I've got one Beastie Boys License to Ill from 1985.
Okay. Nice.
Wow. Well.
And I've got a Pink Floyd Dark Side of the Moon from 1973.
Wow. And that one's sealed as well?
Yeah, they're both sealed. They're original. I inherited them.
That's awesome.
I've had them since like 1994, 95.
Very cool. I have a price on the Pink Floyd, sorry, go ahead.
No, I know that The Dark Side of the Moon probably has a little bit more value than the License to Ill,
sure.
But I figure they're both worth a little something.
Yeah, that Dark
not
Side
in
of
my
Moon,
book, buddy, not in my book.
sealed, they're going for $800.
What?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, the one recently sold sealed from 1974 edition for $800.
Nice job.
I mean, even holy if they're God. Open, as long as they have, there were two stickers and two posters that it came with. As long as you have all that, even open, you're probably looking
don't
at like $100. I obviously I come across the open ones, but that you have it sealed, that is very cool.
Very cool.
And that's, you know, like a mortgage.
All right,
payment.
That's a winner, man.
Yeah, I was told when I received, I was only like 9-10 years old when I got these. I was told never to open them.
Right.
And I never did. I put them in a closet. And
there you go. Strong advice, man.
Yeah,
strong advice.
That person was smart.
Thanks, Matt. All right, let's keep going. Let's
thanks
go to
calling.
Ray. Ray, what do you got, Ray? What do you want to brag about?
I got a box set of 15 Frank Sinatra LPs put out by Capitol. It's got a number on it of 7248.
Hmm. That's cool. What does that mean? What's that 7248?
That's probably the catalog number, I would guess.
It's the only number I can find on the box.
Yeah. Let's see what comes up here.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So they would actually, you could sell the box set of LPs. That's what you got.
It's an LP, yeah. They're all box set.
They're all LP. Yeah, that's not coming up, so that could just might mean it's just that.
Which one? Rare. Which one's got Rubber Plant on it? That's the go-to. That's High Hopes. That's High Hopes, right?
Right.
That's a good one.
I'm not finding one with the record, so you might want to, if you want to write all me right. through Facebook, I can do some more
yeah,
research
you
for you.
There might be some more something. Thanks, Ray.
Sorry.
Oops, there goes another rubber plant. That's all I got. All right, let's go to Joe. Joe, what do you want to brag about? Joe?
Oh, yeah, hi.
Hi.
Never called you before.
Hey, thanks for calling, man.
It's the first time, yeah. I have to go to bed for work. But anyways, I have a bunch of WLS and CFL surveys from the radio stations.
Okay.
Oh, okay, that's cool.
Are they the silver dollar ones or the larger ones?
I do have a few silver dollars. They're all original. There's two of them from April of 61 I have.
Great.
And there's one picture that has Dick Biondi on there. Could
very
you believe
cool.
that?
Yeah, that's great.
And I don't know what this stuff is worth. And then I have some other ones that I would like to sell. I don't have, I'm not on the internet or anything
sure.
like that. I'm more old school. You want to call me that?
You're going door to door?
Yeah, if you can
exactly,
contact
no.
me somehow, have a family member or whatever, contact me through Facebook, DuPage Picker. But the silver dollar ones are awesome. I mean, recently yeah. a set of 52, and it's not a complete set, just 52 of them sold for $1,300. So that is pretty cool.
For what? For a survey?
For the silver dollar ones. They were the thinner ones, maybe about 3 inches wide.
Were they made of
wide.
Silver?
They might as well have been.
Oh,
but
man,
they're
crazy.
Going for good money. The wider ones,
okay.
like from the
sorry.
70s, not as much. I've come across those, and I've sold maybe a lot of 20 of them for like $30. But
$30?
But the silver dollar ones are the ticket there.
Oh, there you go.
What you want.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for calling.
Right, thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
630 says I got the original Legend of Zelda gold cartridge.
Yeah, that's
the with our Nintendo set. Still factory sealed.
Yeah, that's gonna be crazy.
He said I got caught going through Christmas presents.
Okay.
And Dad got mad and he returned most of them, but he kept the game in his sock drawer for 25 years.
Wow.
That Christmas came up in conversation recently, and he pulled it out and asked what it's worth.
Yeah, I see one right now. Someone's asking $4,000 for it. Let me see what they're
the
actually
best, the
going
The best is
for.
The last line where he says, not sure if he gave it to me or if he wants it back.
Yeah. He definitely would
that
want
is,
it back.
That's the Holy Grail, huh?
Yeah, that's kind of that, and there's a couple other like track and field type games. But realistically, one sold for $1,500 in February.
Well, there's a lot of other stuff here, including 224 has got a untorn bleacher tickets to the Windy City Classic that Jordan played in, Esteban Loaiza All-Star jersey. There's a lot of great,
nice.
Such random stuff. Tonight I'll give the Lou Malnati's Pizza, find Lou Malnati's at all locations around Chicago, to the Bo Jackson poster, right? I think that that's the best brag. Him in a, for whatever reason, holding a surfboard.
Yep.
You know, I don't think Bo's going to work out in his football and baseball, so we should get him in every outfit possible.
Yeah,
but
let's
that's
do
a $400
water
poster.
Polo and stuff like that.
So there you go, 773.
Good job.
Malnati's. Good job. Best brag of the night. You can find Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker, and of course, you can find him here every Wednesday night. Greg, thanks for being here, bud.
Thanks.